Can't he be eliminated?
No, he's a symbol of opposition to the administration.
So?
We've done cross-sectional psych readings which show that a high percentage of people, particularly the younger ones, believe that Blake's trial was a showpiece, that his statements were rigged.
His death could be used by the dissidents. They need a hero. Alive or dead, Blake could be it.
I suppose my department could infect him, some rapidly terminal disease. Would his natural death help?
I don't think so.
What we need is something to discredit him.
And eating and drinking, you've managed to do without.
Well, since you were so insistent, I've done without food or drink for 36 hours.
How do you feel?
Hungry and thirsty, of course.
Nothing else.
Ravenna, is this some kind of practical joke?
It's no joke. All our food and drink is treated with suppressants. Going without for a day and a half, they should be wearing off.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 16th of June 2023, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on our wonderful, please do have a look at it. I promise you there's no spyware in there. Well, I'd like to promise you if I knew, I've no idea, but it works, and that's the main thing, and it's put together by Nick, who's a brilliant little software developer, now out in Poland. It's called the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, and you can download it from all good app stores, including the Apple Store. Please don't use Google. If you want to use another Android store, on our show page there's a nice link to another one, and that is at thisweek.org.uk. Yes, please try and avoid using Google unless you absolutely have to. As you probably know by now, all Gmail accounts just get bounced back when I send my weekly email out. Gmail says, oh, no, we're not going to allow that email to be delivered. Here you can have it back. And I've not figured out yet how to sort that one out. In fact, maybe that's Google's little game they're playing with me. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade psyops, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes, cancelling vote winners like Boris and Trump, Bill Gates and Matt Hancock's crimes against humanity all forgotten. For the evil Putin, Goldman Sachs, Nazis, po-faced bunch of Bilderberg death trip losers, Nick Land's dark enlightenment, drones want us slaves in their machines, accelerationist cults with wife-murdering king now waging war on the British people, well, as well as Putin. So this is what the BBC might sound like. Well, I doubt that last little rant would be ever aired on the BBC if it was free of the deep state Zionist octopus. We're joined by singer-songwriter tonight. That is one of Bristol's punk's finest, Rita Lynch, and navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, and Boris, the dead mise of Boris Johnson tonight, as well as maybe Trump too, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. So yes, Trump indictment, we're going to hear a bit about that this week. We'll be focusing though on the resignation of Boris Johnson as an MP. Is this the end for him? Completely the end for Brexit or what? And stealing state secrets, Trump was, but what was actually Boris up to? And in part two, terror assassinations in Serbia, Belgrade arrests two terrorists, armed to the teeth, believed to be Kosovans. The NATO way, if you don't side with us against Russia, we send in the jackals. So Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. And us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet. Despite our this show's role in a small way in the toppling of Edward Colston, and we'll be hearing a bit about that later on, because Christine Townsend has been on the Bristol Cable's Bristol Unplugged podcast this week talking about that. But anyway, so we'll start with you, Rita, tonight. Can you just tell us a little bit about your past and your background and how you ended up on the stage singing, well, screaming to a certain extent, certain songs?
Thank you. Oh gosh, well, a long, 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 long time ago, I started playing guitar as a child, and sort of kind of dropped it a little bit, and then punk rock came along, and it was like a lifeline for myself, and I kind of grabbed it, and my first band was called Rita and the Piss Artists. That was the first lineup. I was very young then. I was about 22, 23, and I didn't even sing. I didn't know I could sing. So I played bass really badly. And we were terrible, but we did about 4 or 5 gigs. And then another local band, God bless you, asked me to play bass and to join in a duet, which I did. And then they said, forget the bass, just sing. And I learnt, I could see how they were writing songs. I learnt a lot from them during my time with them, and I started writing my own songs and then playing on my own many years ago.
So you must have some influences. We all do. I think most of us were. It was when the punks arrived, it was all sweeping out all of the nice little melodies and the smiling, happy singers and songwriters singing deep and meaning, you know, the Simon and Garfunkels and all that. And suddenly punk was on the scene. So yes. Who were your big influences?
Johnny Rotten. Johnny Rotten was a massive influence. But before then, I suppose Bob Dylan was already a massive influence at the time. Bob Dylan, Patti Smith, all the punk people, The Fall, Marky Smith, another big influence.
Oh, yes, wonderful, absolutely. Well, John Peel always used to play him.
Yes.
And I ought to tell you my little John Peel tale told to me by a sound engineer who worked at Wiltshire Sound, who had worked in Network Radio on Radio 1. And he said he loved working with John because everything, he had no ego. Mm-hmm. And he would just talk to you like, you know, like many of the I mean, obviously there's Jimmy Savills and people like that were massive egos, but he wasn't. He would just talk to him as he would to anyone else.
Yes.
And he also used to come into the studio sometimes when John was playing some song, and he'd have his feet up on the mixing desk with the speakers up full, and you could hardly, well, I mean, the whole place was vibrating because the monitors were up absolutely full blast as he was playing this stuff out over the radio. And of course, the fact is that, you know, there's loads of Peels out there. In fact, I interviewed one of them who's I worked with at community radio years ago, and he did a similar sort of thing to John Peel, but of course he's not employed by the BBC. He wasn't putting out all this new music. What's happened to the music scene now? It does seem as if, you know, if there is any good music being produced now, it's certainly not getting airplay on the national stations, national music channels.
No. I think the best radio station is really Radio 6, who do play a really wide selection of unsigned acts and artists as well.
Isn't Peel's son on there?
I think he is, yeah. And Iggy Pop is as well. Iggy Pop does a show on Radio 6. He's brilliant, and with his amazing voice, his gravelly voice. And yeah, Radio 6 is the one, but I'm slightly out of the loop, I suppose, in as much as I just... you know, just if I can just keep going writing songs, then I'm kind of happy with that now.
Okay, so we're going to start with a song of yours. We don't usually start with music, but we will because since you're here, which is it's called Strip Right Away. I mean, I listened to your, you gave me a bunch of CDs, I listened right through them. Okay. And this one stood out to me, and it's quite an old one. It's from 1990. Do you want to say something about it?
It's a very old song. It's one of my earliest songs. It's on my first album, and...
I mean, there's two impossible meanings to this. Either you're tearing your clothes off, or else you're tearing the sort of soul down to its very basics. Which one is it, or both, or what?
Well, I suppose it's always up to each person what they want, but I suppose metaphysically, maybe, yes. yes, a long time ago. Actually, as I remember, I was greatly influenced by Prince at the time.
So which one of those two, you know, when you're talking about stripping away, is it the clothes or the soul or what?
I suppose the soul, the personalities, maybe, that sort of thing.
Well, that does happen, doesn't it, in relationships sometimes, right down to the bone. Anyway, let's have a listen to that now from 1990, Rita Lynch with Stripped Right Away.
Strip
and Strip Right Away. That's obviously live. There's a bit of clapping going on in the background there, unless you had a whole studio full of fans, Rita, from 1990, Strip Right Away. Do you want to just say something about your current, what you're up to musically at the moment and where you are?
Yes, okay. Musically, these days, I still play with John Langley. He is my drummer. And from the Blue Aeroplanes, and we're doing a gig on Sunday at the Louisiana supporting a singer-songwriter called Eddie Mole. It's a night of art noir, so that should be a really, it's a three-band lineup. That would be a good gig to
Is that the same John Langley we had on here a few months ago? I wonder. The ex-porn star who stood as mayor. Is it a different John Langley? Or
yeah.
It's a different one. Okay. Right. Phew. Okay. So I didn't know he was a drummer, but no, he's not a drummer. Actually, no. Okay. So, and one of the main reasons I asked you to come along is nothing to do with any of this music. It's lovely to have that as a sort of in the background, but it's to do with the special educational needs. And we'll start, I think, by just talking to Martin a bit about that, who works in schools, don't you, Martin? In fact, you've worked in the whole kind of school policy area almost since you left university. So what is happening now to special educational needs? It's a bit worrying that, I mean, my feeling is if we're paying taxes, this is the sort of basic thing it should go to, looking after kids who have got learning difficulties of various sorts or are disabled. And to me, if you're not able to do that properly, then you may as well not bother paying your tax.
Well, I did, when I left university in 1980, I did go to work for an alternative school called Kirkdale in South London. And eventually I was which had been there since 1964. So it already lasted for quite a long time. And in the years I was there, we were talking to the Inner London Education Authority about becoming part of the setup, being part of the system. And White Line Street Free School had become part of the system. ILA funded that, but that had started as a unit for dealing with kids who were excluded from other schools. Whereas Kirkdale had started as parents coming together with teachers to do new, you know, basically a different style of education than the one you got in the mainstream. And the ILEA were quite interested in funding because they'd already funded White Lion Street. The Labour leadership of the ILEA, our local councillor Lewis Herbert, who was very close to Ken Livingstone, was quite happy. You know, we were progressing this. The problem I had with the parents at the Kirkdales, they didn't want to lose the control that they'd had as, you know, parents. If we went into the system, they would lose that. But of course, they didn't have any money. And soon afterwards, after we parted the ways, that collapsed. There is, in fact, a woman teacher who has set up an exactly the same sort of project in London now, but she's had to crowdfund it. So it will be free for kids to go, but it won't be part of the system at all. It's going to be crowdfunded by those who are interested in this sort of thing.
It's one of these sort of free school type things. What about the way that local authorities have been deprived of the money to teach these kids?
Yeah, all right. Well, the reason I say that is just to give a bit of background, because one of the arguments I made to the ILEA was that we're already integrating special needs kids with other kids. It was just normal for us. There was a whole spectrum of kids we got in the school. There's only 30 kids in the school. It's a little unit. Some of them are going to go on to university to study physics.
Doesn't that hold back the brighter kids?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't at all. In actual fact, what you find is that I remember teaching one kid who was, you know, he knew anything about maths, but poor old David didn't know anything about maths. And it was really, really challenging for Spencer to explain maths to David. He knew it, but explaining it to David was a challenge.
Is it a bit of a cop-out for the teachers to get the bright kids to explain it to the not-so-bright kids?
All right, anyway, the point is that the 1980 Education Act said that, in principle, all kids should be educated in the same institutions. We're not going to segregate them out, unless there's a reason, yeah? And that was the argument I was making.
Unless their parents have got loads of money to send
the private. You can't do anything about that because they're going to do their own thing anyway. Although obviously at the next election there's going to be a debate about whether they should lose, they should pay VAT on school fees, which we can come to in a minute if you like. But anyway, what's actually happened in mainstream schools where I work now, I'm a teaching assistant. You know, I work with the teachers, and mostly I'm working with special needs kids who are inside mainstream schools, although I have worked in special schools as well. So I get moved around a lot. I've done a lot of different places, and I've got, you know, quite over a decade of experience doing it in Bristol now. And the problem, like all of these things, is resources. It's money. Like, if you haven't got resources, you can't do anything. And, you know, we need bodies, really. You know, so if we've got a kid that can't sit in the class with the others and needs to have a different programme, then that needs at least one person to take them away and do that with them. Sometimes you can bunch kids together, so you can do, you know, they take a little group of them away, but often the needs they have are specific. So the little group doesn't gel in the way that you'd like, because, of course, they've got different needs in that little group. All of these things have come to a head because the special needs has been expanding in terms of the money that's spent on it. The Tory government's austerity people, like when Zahawi was in charge, he was saying, we've got to get this special needs budget down because it's running away from us. Because what it's based on is supposedly an assessment of somebody's needs, and if they fulfil the criteria, then they're entitled to the money. But there is no budget for it. The local authorities have to pay the money out, but they haven't got a specific budget from the government for that. The local authorities have had everything else cut back, then find that if they fund special needs, I mean, as you know, the big thing in Bristol at the moment is the special needs spend last year could bankrupt the council. Now, the problem isn't the council, the problem is that there's no budget for special needs. And of course, as you said earlier, Tony, we should be spending money on this, but in fact we bailed the banks out, went to war in Iraq, and we're going to go to war with Russia, and that's where the money's gone.
Yeah, one of the councils, I think it's southwest London somewhere, in the suburbs, has just gone bankrupt.
Yes, it's what
Woking,
because they got involved in property speculation. Because this is what happens when you've got no central government budget. You think, I know, we'll get some money by going, we'll build a tower block and make some money that way. But then they didn't make money.
Actually,
they're
probably giving themselves planning permission to build that tower block.
Well, indeed, that's right. But then what's happened is that local councils shouldn't be doing stuff like that. They should be funding special educational needs. That's what they should be doing.
Well, the latest news from the BBC is bankrupt Woking Borough Council will continue to operate. A council report said the authority will continue to operate, but with financial controls. The council will continue to pay staff and deliver statutory services. Oh, goody. So that we've actually still got something for the local council tax that's being paid there. So anyway, do you want us to just say something about your son, Rita, because, you know, he's been caught up in it, you've been caught up in this enormous great cutback. One of the latest stories in the local press about the special educational needs is that Bristol City Council's SEND scandal, this is from last month, cost taxpayers £15,000 in 7 months. A catalogue of failures by Bristol City Council to provide education for youngsters has led to watchdogs upholding 9 complaints in the last 7 months at a cost of more than £15,000 in compensation. It can be revealed several of the children and young people with special needs and disabilities were left without any adequate teaching and support for months, whilst their education, healthcare and plans, which the authority is responsible for setting out what should be provided, suffered long delays. So that's just £15,000 in compensation, but nothing can really compensate a child or a parent for just not being educated.
Well, no. I suppose my journey with my son, who is now 21, has... it's hard to know where to start, but these last few years I've become more aware that As a child, you have more rights. But once, as somebody, my son has got quite severe autism, learning disabilities, and epilepsy. Once you reach 18, the Mental Capacity Act comes into full throttle to control the life of the disabled person if they lack capacity, which my son does. Which means that as a parent, once they're 18, you have very little. The person who has most power over your young person is the social workers, social care and social workers. And that is quite shocking, because also once they reach 18, all the lovely laws that protect children are all over. And there is no protection for the young person who still, say my son can't go out the front door on his own, so he has very limited freedom anyway. And yes, it's been quite shocking, just how very little power you have as a parent then, and how the social workers have all the power, yet you have all the responsibility, and they don't really help you what they're very good at saying is, if you come up with really cool ideas, oh no, you can't have that. Oh no, you can't have that. Oh no, 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 no. That's all you get. No, no, no. A very, very recent, my son was expelled. My son went to, when he was, after school age, he went to a college in Wiltshire, Fairfield Farm College. Me and my son's family, we thought it would be good for him to be more residential, and that's what happened to him, but it backfired so very terribly. Within months, his house was disintegrating. His epilepsy came back worse than ever in his life, and he started piling on stones of weight. After the Christmas, I was worried for his life, and then we called a best interest meeting, which is what you have to do when somebody's over 18. And I was able to get my son home, by which time he'd put on about 3 stone in that time, and his epilepsy had gone way out of control. And so I got him back to kind of, you know, look after him and put him back together again, which is what I'm doing now, with very, very little help from social care. He was expelled from the only specialist college in Bristol, which is Ashley Down. He was expelled, and his own condition was used against him, and that was the end of his education.
I mean, this is a terribly sad story, isn't it? But at the end of the day, surely the council has got... I mean, there was at this centre school, is it called St Christopher's, I think? I don't know if your
yes.
son ever went there.
No.
But we've just had news that it was shut down under at the tail end of the previous mayor. I suppose that's, what, about 7 years ago?
Yeah. Yes.
That's 2016-ish. And now it's just being sold off. So the basic facilities were there, weren't they? In a way, we had after the Second World War this St Christopher's in Bristol as a special school for kids with special educational needs, although they probably were called something different back then, was set up. We also had the, I think it was called Remploy. Yeah, Remploy, which was the idea that disabled people shouldn't have to go out there and compete with able-bodied people in the work market. It almost seems as if, Rita, that this whole concept after the war that was there, that anyone that's you know, either educationally subnormal, disabled, disadvantaged in one way or another in their education or in their work, needs some sort of special help from... you know, funded through government, funded through taxes, is slowly, slowly ebbing away. And it's now almost like a kind of survival of the fittest.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's been, even in the time, my time with my son, which is, you know, he's 21, it's very, very hard to get funding for anything. But saying that, they are prepared to pay huge amounts of money for your interview. So when my son went to Fairfield Farm College, I was told it probably cost about £2,000 a week for him to go there. And they weren't very good because they did a lot of things that weren't good for my son, and we got him home again. So they're prepared to pay huge amounts of money for really rubbish facilities, the really rubbish institutions that talk the talk, but actually the reality is my son nearly died, and now he's doing really well, but he's back with me. But social care are giving me very little help. I haven't had overnight respite or one night off for 2 years and 3 months.
Well, that's respite care is desperately necessary,
yes,
isn't it? You know, the idea that someone trustworthy is looking after your son whilst you have a few days off. I mean, otherwise, that means you don't have any time at all.
I have no time at all, no.
Martin?
Well, that's, yes, I mean, your situation obviously is very, very distressing, but it's, as you're probably aware, you're not the only one. There's a lot of people struggling with this stuff because it's ultimately about resources. There are certain things people... I mean, what's positive about special needs in the time I've been involved in it is there's more willingness to recognise it than it was when I was at school. Mm-hmm. You know, these kids were just naughty or stupid or whatever. You know, that's changed.
Is it really about... I think it's maybe more about priorities than it is about money. I mean, we've seen £50 million poured down the drain with these pet projects of Bristol Energy, for example. So there are, it seems, things like holding a massive event for various mayors around the world to jet into Bristol to have a parliament of mayors. It just seems to me, Martin, it's not just about the... I mean, money is obviously a part of this because there's enormous cuts to local government. But the mayor's office is sitting here thinking, oh, special educational needs, what's that? You know, well, it's not about my career, so let's forget it.
Well, that is what is happening in Bristol, but it's the same as true across the country. Look at what we mentioned, Woking there. Woking Council has gone bust investing in property. Now, that is because local authorities have been pushed to do this entrepreneurial stuff instead of getting on with the basic bread and butter stuff. But there's still a fundamental problem. There is no budget for special needs. If the council were given a specific budget for it, that's what they'd have to spend it on. But there isn't. And that's what, and the local councils know, the less they spend on special needs, the more money they might have for their pet projects.
It's also a private sector mentality that's creeping into the public sector, isn't it? I mean, you and I know that there is a public sector mentality which is about public service, which is, for example, through the old school utilities, these sorts of things, where someone is, I mean, for example, everybody knows that the fire service, the ambulances, the doctors in the NHS, they're all working effectively. They're not just trying to carve out a career for themselves. They're doing public service work. They're often getting paid under the odds. They're often going to get a lower pension than people who are working in the public sector, Lynch. Rita. And I just think that what seems to be going on is the whole of what we're paying our taxes towards. Yeah. The local authority, Bristol City Council, is just becoming almost like a business.
Yes, I think so. I think so. And I also think that people who've got significant learning disabilities, and I'm talking about people who are over 18, because when you're a child, you are very much protected by the child laws.
There's a lot more. These AHCPs that they've brought in now,
yes,
they do go up.
What was that stand for again, Martin?
They're supposed to go in education, health and care plan.
Okay. Yeah, but previously you used to have what was called a statement which yes. only lasted till when you were 16.
Yeah. Yes, and this is under the understanding that your person needs a more wrapped around education.
Well, I mean, they ain't going to change. But somebody at 16 doesn't change their personality or their problems, do they? Yeah.
No, of course not. No,
just
of course not.
Just because you've stopped being a child, that doesn't mean you don't need help, does it?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in some ways, your problems kind of grow with you, and you know, you're not.
You may need more support because you've got to be independent, whereas children, you know, have got that support absolutely all the time, haven't they?
And I suppose this 0 to 25, though, is a bit of a lie, because I've been trying to get my son back into education after his education, health and care plan was deceased when he was expelled from City of Bristol College last January. And they keep on saying how unusual this is for me to be trying to get Jimmy back into education at the age of 21. But then I wonder, why do they bother with 0 to 25 if it's that unusual? Why just say 0 to whenever we feel like it, sort of thing? Well, because
there's supposed to be this concept of lifetime learning as well, surely. I mean, you know, people should be able to access things they need at any age.
I know, but the reality is, and I've been working flat out on this for about 2 years now, trying to up my son's game, and there's a lot of things that they say you're entitled to, but when you actually try to get them, it's really almost impossible.
Well, that's what I would say. Working in the sector, I would say that the people, the SENCOs in the schools where I work, a lot of their jobs is trying to get this money out, because it's like trying to get blood out of a stone.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Bristol City Council were found guilty of is that when people put in these massive applications, there's a load of paperwork involved, you've got to evidence everything. When the emails came in, they were told not to answer the emails.
Not even to open the
email. Not open the emails, because once you've opened the email, you've then got a legal requirement to do something within 3 months, I think it is.
God,
so
terrible.
What they were doing was just letting them pile up.
The
parents took them to court, and they lost in court because they weren't fulfilling their statutory obligations. Now, I would argue that local authorities should be doing their statutory obligations, like providing support for special needs children and adults. But they've got to have a budget for it.
Well, there's some
which,
stuff.
You know, they need a budget for it.
There's some stuff in the Bristol Post which suggests that maybe it's just not the budget that's the problem. Bristol City Council spent more on the Bristol Beacon, which is the old Colston Hall, which, funnily enough, about 8 years ago was refurbished. It's now being refurbished again. Mm. It was refurbished, you know, a fantastic refurbishment, as far as I know. They're now spending loads more money on it. Bristol City Council spent more on the Bristol Beacon, used to be called the Colston Hall, than building homes or schools last year, accounts show. Bristol City Council's written off £93 million so far on the refurbishment of the concert hall. poured another £22.5 million into Bristol Beacon last year, more than it spent on building new homes, expanding schools or low-carbon energy projects. An opposition councillor criticised the decision as a massive drain on the authority's finances, with every penny instantly written off and the concert venue continuing to be valued at zero in the City Hall's accounts because there's more being spent than the building is worth. I mean, this is right in central Bristol, folks. It's an enormous, great, big, famous old concert hall and venue. We used to hold our Bristol Community FM events in there, that sort of thing. It's all shut at the moment again. So the council said the true value of the investment to the city's economy will ultimately dwarf the financial costs of the works. As previously reported, the cost of the renovation has almost tripled from an original £48 million to £132 million after the state of the Victorian Hall was found to be a worst-case scenario, with discoveries including hollow pillars holding up roofs. Okay, maybe they're like scaffolding poles or something. Maybe that's just normal. Unknown Elizabethan well shafts and structurally unsound hidden arches that were covered up. So, yeah, I mean, this is bizarre, Rita, isn't it? That we should have a refurbishment of the Colston Hall about 8 years ago, 8-10 years ago. Which took about a year. It was open as a spectacular new venue, and now all of a sudden they've shut it again, and they're pouring, how much did I say? £132 million into that. Now, I mean, this is the sort of thing that the council might even say, well, why do we actually need a concert hall? There's a private arena being built. And anyway, why didn't we just leave it as it was? I mean, it does. Yeah. So what I suppose I'm trying to say here is this is a pet project considered to be much more important than actually the basic stuff, which I'm afraid won't bring them any awards or medals.
Yeah.
But it's the basic stuff that needs doing.
Well, absolutely. And it's very, very, very upsetting as a parent of a special needs young man who is getting very, very little support and help when a lot of money is being wasted on something. I can't help but feel sometimes that there is an underlying prejudice towards people with special needs, especially when they become adults, because everyone likes the cute little kiddies when they've got autism, but those cute little kiddies grow up to be great big adults, and they're not so cute. And maybe they make funny noises, and maybe whatever. And yeah, I'm just quite shocked that money has been spent on so many other things. And also, when we sent my son out of Bristol for his college, we only did so because there's hardly anything in Bristol. And once again, I think Bristol should be trying to create more opportunities for special needs adults in Bristol, not spending huge amounts of money to send them out of Bristol, because it doesn't help you create your own community when you're far away either. So it's been a journey, but that's quite shocking, yes.
Martin?
Well, I mean, obviously there's something like this leads in so many different directions, doesn't it? I, in principle, accept that special needs children should, in principle, be educated alongside their peers. Unless there's a good reason not. And sometimes there's frequently some kids just cannot fit into the school system as it's currently constituted, so they have to have something special for them. And of course, those special schools can be special. And I have worked in special schools in Bristol. I've worked in Pegasus, which deals with just autistic kids. It's a very small school up in Filton. And I've worked in Woodlands, which is up in Avonmouth, which is for kids who really got problems. You know, they've got behavioural problems, they won't fit in, they're just very rebellious. But in actual fact, once they're in the Woodlands, they thrive, because it's a very controlled environment.
I do completely differ with you on, you know, you're a kind of pro-comprehensive, pro-Shirley Williams, who, by the way, was a traitor to the Labour Party. She left them, ditched them in the doo-doos, didn't she, back in the 1970s. She was pro-comprehensive. I'm much more into the idea of taking people's skills and abilities at 11, finding out what they're into, and then sticking them in schools with each other.
At 11?
For example,
Well, the grammar school system.
The 11 plus. Yeah. After the Second World War, they decided to do this.
One of the reasons why the grammar school system was abolished.
It's called the Butler Report, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you know it well.
Yeah. One of the reasons why the grammar school system was abolished, Tony, is that when people did the 11 plus at 11, once they made it an intelligence test as opposed to a school test, the wrong kind of kids started passing, And the other thing they found was that girls were more intelligent than boys.
Well, that was the whole
boys.
Point of the Butler Report, well, which was yes. actually put together by the Labour yes. government after the war.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what they were saying is we want a top-notch education for poor kids
yeah.
Who are bright. When they're, yes. when they're shown to be bright.
But that's
bright
got nothing to do with special
old.
Needs. I'm changing the subject.
Well, I'm saying different types of school for different types
all right,
of kids.
All right, but let's
is actually not such a bad... And you've had your say on the other one. So what do you think about
I
this,
I actually am a big fan of special schools. I'm not a big fan of inclusion. My son did inclusion, and it was awful for him. He went to a neurotypical primary school, and I just think that I think inclusion is really good for the neurotypical children because it gives them access to different types of people, but for the actual disabled child it's not very good. It's too underfunded.
It's been carried too far, the idea
and they think they can just force them into toe the line, and it's a pretend. My son used to have his back to the teacher, but they're all really happy with him because he was passive, and that's not getting an education. So I think inclusion is a cheapskate way, and it's pretend, and that's what I would say from my experience.
One of the things that's worrying, isn't it, that if kids are kicking off, then they tend to, someone's going to prescribe them something to calm them down, a kind of chemical cosh.
Yes.
That sort of thing happens as well. And even with older people, you know, the idea is, you just turn them into a kind of, you know, I hate to say it, but like a zombie, you know, feed them some kind of midazolam or whatever they call it. I don't think that's actually that at all, but maybe, antipsychotic, antidepressant that just turns them off. And then they're no trouble. So that, of course, has got its own kind of Nazi-like problems. But look, I mean, we don't want to be getting too suicidal, depressed here about the absolutely disastrous state of our education system and the fact that our leaders, so-called leaders, don't seem to give a damn about some of the most vulnerable people in society that we would rather prefer that they spent our money on. Yes. Rather than their own pet projects and their own careers. So let's have a listen now to someone who's going to cheer us up a little bit. And his name is Mick Lynch. He's the leader of the Rail Maritime Transport, and he's a union, and he's the successor of Bob Crowe. You know, if people remember him, the great big guy on Question Time that used to tear through all the absolute nonsense and rubbish spoken on there every week, whenever he was allowed on, and tell him what's what. So anyway, here's Mick Lynch with this is what apparently he thinks the government doesn't want you to know, and of course it uses the mainstream press in order to try and silence voices like his.
Where unions are weak, workers get poorer. Where unions are weak, the rich get richer. If you've got a super rich elite that is intent on becoming richer, and the means by which they become richer is to make the rest of the society poorer, it's trade unions and their democracy that is the hope of working people. All of the wealth in our society is created by workers, and it's their labour that creates the super rich. And you've got to ask these people, how rich do they need to be? If you're worth 10 billion, do you need to be worth 20 billion? What we need in this country and all other countries is a distribution of wealth so that those that do the work and create the wealth get a fair share of the fruits of their labour. If you take health workers and educators and people providing public services, most of those people haven't had a pay rise for nearly a decade. We know that wealth is being transferred to the super rich in our society, and it's the ordinary women and men around this country, often in low paid or modestly paid jobs, that are paying the price. Many workers can't keep up with the cost of living and are facing really difficult choices, and they're turning to their trade unions to defend them. They're turning to the unions in order to get a square deal off corporate Britain. And because they've lost the argument, the Tories are now seeking to change the law, and they do that a lot. Whenever they lose an argument, they seek to get a bogeyman, which is the trade unions, and now they're seeking to repress the right to strike. And nobody voted for this government. The government is proposing a whole set of anti-union laws, which originated with Kwasi Kwarteng when he was around for a couple of weeks, and are now being taken up again by the government. And what that actually means, when you strip it down, is that workers will be conscripted, forced to go to work against their will. Now, that is something that is really, really a bad development. It's an oppression of your right to withdraw your labour, which is, in international law, a right that every worker in the world should have. So it is a real form of suppression of human rights and a really dangerous and dark development, the sort of thing that we had from oppressive regimes in the Eastern Bloc and before that in fascist Europe and other totalitarian regimes in the past, where workers are not allowed to express their rights and indeed they're not allowed to campaign against poverty, which is what the trade unions are mainly doing. And of course, coupled with the police bill and other law and order bills that they're bringing in, they're actually suppressing the right to express yourself at all. and protest against things that you see as incorrect in our society. It's not easy to strike now. The trade unions have to jump through all sorts of hoops and hurdles, and in the future that will be even more difficult. But the importance of the unions being a source of opposition and being a source of dissent in our society and a source of freedom cannot be underestimated. So if you take our own history, the ability to vote to get universal suffrage was supported by the trade unions. Having the weekend and time off is a trade union campaign. Sick pay, holiday pay, premium pay for overtime, the right to get annual leave. All these issues have been fought for by trade unions in the UK and, of course, all around the world, where people have got a more advanced form of living. In societies where you don't have free trade unions, all of those things have been stripped away. And if trade unions are oppressed, the people of this country will be oppressed fairly quickly after. The government is going after the unions because we've got a kind of consensus politics in this country at the minute where the official opposition, Labour and Liberal Democrats and others, don't really seem to be asserting themselves as a real opposition. And the trade unions are putting up an opposition. And the main issue at the minute in the UK is the cost of living crisis. And of course, the job of the trade unions is to negotiate good terms and conditions, good pensions, good sick pay, good holiday pay, and fundamentally good wages, so that people can afford to pay their mortgages, their rents, their food bills, their clothing bills, and of course their energy bills, which is a fundamental at the moment. So the government quite rightly sees the trade unions as an opposition, a focal point for dissent. And instead of dealing with that, taking it head on and maybe winning an argument against us, which, you know, they're entitled to put up their argument in a free society, or even better, making deals with us so that we get compromises and we can settle some of these disputes, they're trying to make us illegal. And that's exactly what repressive regimes do all around the world. We don't want that here. We want a free society where trade unions can operate in a democratic way.
What a hero.
Even Martin nearly clapped there.
Well, I don't want to be seen to be biased, just, <don't you?
laughs> Of course not. Well, yeah, of course, he says that very interesting little bits and pieces there, like nobody voted for this government. He's right, of course.
That's not true.
No, it is. This government is run by Rishi Sunak.
Oh, I see what you mean, okay.
You know what the government is, Martin? It's not necessarily the ruling party. No. The government is the faction within the ruling party that happens to have taken over at the time. So nobody voted for Sunak and Goldman Sachs. Nobody voted for this. And he's quite right when he says that. Do you think he's right when he says that actually the biggest thing is, never mind anything else, is the cost of living crisis, Rita? He's being quite certain about saying that is the main issue right now in the country.
I suppose it is, yes, the cost of living, the fuel bills, the cost of living, rents, people having very little rights, no longer legal aid, and the cost of living just making all these things even harder and giving people fewer choices. I think he's absolutely right.
Well, I've started using cabs more these days, because if I try and drive into the city centre, it's now costing me £12 or something. So I can use a cab to go, you know, sort of half a mile or a mile or something. Usually it's about a fiver. So it's cheaper to use the cab than it is to drive my car. So, and of course, they are public, taxi drivers are public transport. You know, we need them. We do need them. And it enables people to leave their cars at home or get rid of their cars if the cabs. And my cabbie was telling me on the other day on the way into town that his electricity bill was £150 a month. It's now £350 a month. So it's gone up over double just in the last year and a half. So these are the sorts of things which, in a way, you'd expect a kind of fascist government, if it's controlled by these big companies, to just crank up these amounts, crank up what you're paying for electricity, water, gas, whatever it is, just because they can. Because, you know, their effect, and maybe Martin, you can say something about this. Surely this is price fixing. It's not actually a demand and supply. It's not because the price of energy for them is going up. It's just that their ability to up the price. There's no other proper competition.
Well, it is price fixing on one level, because of course energy prices are set in the spot market, which is, you know, basically speculators, and you know, every time there's a shock like an invasion of Ukraine, then they can make money on the back of that, and that forces the price up.
And I noticed also the solar prices and the wind price. I was looking into this the other day. They are all fixed on the gas price.
Yeah.
So as people, you know, it doesn't matter how much it costs to generate the solar or the wind power, even if it's dirt cheap, you still have to pay the same amount of price for it as the gas. Well, so this is good for the companies that own those things.
Yes. Well, so what it means is that
it's not a free market.
No, it never was a free market. I mean, things like oil and gas and so on, you need a massive infrastructure to have them, which is why you got nationalised oil industry in Norway. They found the oil at the bottom of the North Sea the same time we did, and they set up Statoil, which is owned by the Norwegian government, with unions on the board of the thing, and all the money they made from that went to pay for things like special needs in Norway. Mm. What the money was spent on here was making people unemployed and privatising things, because that's what they wanted to spend it on. And that, and of course, we've in the North Sea, the US companies which dominate the North Sea have never allowed trade unions in there at all. Anybody who tries to form trade unions, they sack them immediately. And that's what led directly to the Piper Alpha disaster in the 1980s, because the accommodation platform for the workers was right over the wellhead, because that's the way to save money. So when it blew up, they were all incinerated. In the Norwegian sector of the North Sea, two separate platforms, the wellhead and the accommodation block. But of course, what's actually happened now in Norway is, because of the bombing of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline by the Americans, according to Seymour Hersh, the Norwegians are now the biggest suppliers of gas to Europe. And they've had a massive, and it's a windfall for them. But all that windfall money coming to the Norwegian government because of their collusion with this terrorist act will go into the coffers for things like special needs kids. It won't go into the pockets of individual
capitalists. Military involved in that, of course.
That's right. That's what Simon Hirsch is suggesting. Now, but the point I'm making is that the Norwegian National Wealth Fund is rolling in money at the moment, but all that money is money that they... I mean, it's a pretty evil thing to be involved in, because you're basically screwing everybody else in Europe on behalf of the Americans. And, of course, the Russians are very well aware that they did it. And, of course, Norway's a lot closer to Russia than it is to America, and they may live to regret that. But the point is, because it's a nationalised industry, all that money that they're raking in is actually money that they can use to pay pensioners' bills if the prices are too high, and invest in the future of their children, which is why you have a nationalised industry. The Russian oil and gas industry is nationalised, which is why they can afford to fight the war in the Ukraine. Whereas everything we do is scam. The people running it are just making money for themselves, and they're not really bothered about whether it works or not, because that's not
the
point.
Well, they're making a big hoo-ha about Ukraine. Are you saying effectively that this is all just sabre-rattling, they couldn't possibly win against the Russians anyway?
I think that's absolutely the case, although they imagine otherwise. They thought that the sanctions on Russia would collapse the Russian economy. That's not what's happened. In actual fact, it's the German economy that's going to collapse. And anybody who thinks, oh, that'll be good, our economy is the weakest of all, and we will go down the drain.
They seem to be making a bit of a habit of coming up with the wrong solutions, don't they, to everything. It's almost like when, you know, now they're upping interest rates in order to, apparently, to bring down inflation. But they've got it all wrong, because the type of inflation they're trying to bring down is where people have got so much money they'll pay over the odds, and so prices start going up. People haven't got too much money, and they haven't got enough money, so they've got it all wrong. And I do wonder if this is not accelerationist, dark enlightenment thinking here, where it's deliberately getting it wrong, because they're actually making money. Isn't it Naomi Klein wrote that book about disaster capitalism?
Yeah,
people are making money out of this.
They are. And of course there's a clear benefit to the Americans of all of this, because they're wrecking the European economy as a competitor. And of course they're forcing the European countries to buy loads of their weapons so that we can all go to war with the Russians to keep the Americans happy. But I think there's going to be some kickback on this coming sooner or later.
I think one of the most fascinating angles on all of this is the Extinction Rebellion and people like that saying, oh, the biggest threat to humanity is climate. Well, of course, climate is a threat to humanity, especially when the rain don't rain, as it hasn't been doing this week. It's been rather lovely, actually, I have to say. Absolutely gorgeous on the coast. And but we're hearing from one of their ideologues, George Monbiot, this week. He's a Guardian columnist. That there is another massive threat to life on Earth. It's not just climate. Any idea what it might be, Rita?
The threat to life on Earth.
What is the biggest threat to life on Earth? People. Okay, people. Martin, would you like to guess?
Oh, aliens.
I think I've picked some of this up. What was he going on about?
The greatest threat to life. It's not nuclear war.
No.
It's not climate change.
It's not nuclear war. It's not financial collapse. It's, what is it?
It's not disinformation making people all do the wrong things. It's not dodgy jabs that might make you sick. It's...
There's a fundamental truth which most people just don't want to hear, which is that the greatest threat to life on Earth is farming.
Farming?
No. Hang on a moment. It can't be farming. farming is the greatest cause of habitat destruction, the greatest cause of biodiversity loss, the greatest cause of extinction, one of the greatest causes of climate breakdown, one of the greatest causes of water pollution, the greatest cause of soil destruction, the greatest cause of water loss. Tick, 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 all those boxes. It's farming which comes out either right on top, because every hectare of land that you're using for an extractive industry like farming is land not used for forests, for wetlands, for savannas, for all the other crucial habitats which are essential to prevent the collapse of our ecosystems, which will also lead to our destruction.
Well, I'll spare you the rest of that rant, but I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I just do love the way George starts off with something so utterly absurd and then tries to justify it. I mean, he's really there talking about modern farming. He's not talking about organic farming. So, for example, an organic farm where you're using horses, you're not using any fuel, that doesn't use any resources, George. And the problem with, for example, fertilizers going into the rivers, well, that used to be sorted out by the National Rivers Agency and also the old water boards. Anyone that was, because they were regularly testing the water quality in our rivers, and before privatization in the 1970s, the water boards were making sure that farmers didn't do that, and if they did, they would be fined individually and not just allowed to get away with it, as they have been ever since. So, what he seems to be suggesting there is that we turn our farmland, Rita, over to things like forests. And I mean, it'd be very nice for the trees, obviously for the birds that live in the forests and things like that. But
oh, yes.
At the end of the day, I mean, we kind of started as a civilization because the farmers started providing a bit of surplus food so that not everyone had to be farmers. So this sounds to me as if he wants us to go back to that day, those days where everyone has to be farmers. Anyway, that's a bit of a convoluted argument. But what do you make of this big threat?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know really, except that I think, because I'm a big believer in organic, and I think if farmers maybe weren't doing such great big extensive farming with all their terrible chemicals.
Well, yeah, industrial agriculture, yeah, it's like turning it into a factory floor.
Yes, and I can see that would be ruining a lot of good things, and maybe if there were smaller farms and organic and had to be not just about making a profit.
Well, yeah, local authorities, Martin, the county councils particularly, used to have things called county farms, didn't they, which were about 20 acres or so, where anyone could really get into farming if they fancied it as a career. They could become a small farmer and then leave the small farm and take on a big one as a tenant farmer.
Well, that's right, and of course that's been got rid of as part of the, you know, the changes that have happened in our lifetime.
Sold off.
I think what he's doing there is he's saying something controversial because he knows it'll get everybody's backs up. So then everybody's taking notice about what he's saying. That's all very well as a kind of look at me tactic, but then the question is the meat of what he's actually saying. I agree with Rita that the real problem we've got all over the world, not just in this country, is industrialised agriculture. You look at what's going on in the Brazilian Amazon, they're clear-cutting forest in order to put cattle on it so that they can make beef, which can be turned into beef burgers for the United States market. And it only lasts 2 or 3 years because the land isn't suitable for that. So then they go and clear another lot. This is absolutely bonkers. They don't need to be doing that at all. In actual fact, at the same time, the best land in Brazil, which is on the east side of the country, is dominated by big landowners. And the obvious solution to that is put all the poor, small farmers onto the big landowners' land and dispossess the big landowners. This is exactly what happened in some revolutions in the Third World in recent years and before. And ultimately, this is a battle between the poor farmers, the peasants, if you like, and the landlord class, the latifundists, and the people who back them in the West. And it's actually a war. People die in it every day. And it's not about why don't we go back to having a nice, cool, organic agriculture, and we'll all be friendly with each other and so on. It's actually a battle, and that's what he's missing. It's not just a question of a technical decision to do this or that.
Also, it strikes me that the regulations have actually, and this is from the Ministry of Agriculture, have actually encouraged industrial agriculture.
Of course, because that was modernisation.
The idea is that this is much more efficient, and all we need to do, surely, is to tweak the policy to say, well, actually, we were wrong. We don't need to use loads of fertilisers. We don't need to use loads of pesticides. Let's all go organic, as you were saying, Rita. It surely is the quality of the food is better, and actually, you might need to have more land growing food, more land growing livestock, etc., if you're going to feed the same number of people on an organic basis.
And you've got to get rid of the big industrial farmers as well, because that land can't, you know, the idea that we can have a little bit of organic over here and the big industrial farmers over here. And the industrial farmers in the West are only viable because of subsidy anyway.
Do you know
so it's all a joke.
You know, one of the biggest recipients of farming, in fact, Kevin Carhill told us here that the Queen, when she was alive, bless
that's
her.
That's right.
Now, it's the Crown Estates. They are the biggest, one of the two or three biggest recipients of farm subsidies.
Well, you get farm subsidy for running a grouse moor.
Yeah. And amazing, isn't it? But the thing is, it's a very simple thing to do. All you do is you say, well, if you've got more than 400 acres, you're not going to get any subsidy for it. So if you've got 5,000, 20,000, 40,000 acres, well, you know, you're only going to get, you have to choose your 400 acres. You can only get subsidy for that little bit.
Well, I spoke to French farmers years ago because I did a PhD thesis which I didn't complete about Polish farming. The French farmers were saying what we want is a subsidy per working farmer. Yeah. So what we're really conserving here is working farmers. And they won't have a massively wealthy lifestyle, but we give them the basic.
So it's nothing to do with the amount of land they've got?
No, because you've got to have some flexibility in the system. Do you know what I mean? You might want. I mean, what's happened in Russia and Belarus with the collective farming, it's quite interesting. In Lithuania, they've and the Baltic states, they've decollectivised completely and everybody a little piece of land, but of course they couldn't really use it and the mafia took it all over and they've basically been driven off the land, and you know it's a horrific situation. Over the border in Belarus, where Lukashenko's in power, he was a collective farm manager and they basically have carried on doing collective farming in the old Soviet way. Most people are used to doing it like that, that's how they do it, and if you think about it, it's very flat. You don't, you know, there's not really much sense in having lots of little individual farms. But I mean, I think there are various solutions to these problems. But the real problem underlying all of this is that the US from the 1970s onwards has subsidized its own agriculture in order to destroy everybody else's. The only reason why that didn't happen in Europe is because of the Common Agricultural Policy. And that's what the Common Agricultural Policy was there for, because otherwise we'd all have been eating US subsidized stuff. For the rest of the world, they are all eating US subsidized stuff. And as Kissinger long ago pointed out, if you are feeding the people of a country, they ain't going to vote against you at the UN, because it's just we're going to cut off your food supply. Simple as that. And so countries like Bangladesh, for example, when it comes up to a vote on the Iraq war, the Americans remind them, you know, we're the ones who are feeding you. Just don't forget it.
Do you want to starve? Vote against this if you want to starve. Yeah, interesting. Okay, so any of your thoughts about what's going on with our food prices? Because, Rita, you know, we've got something, I think it's the latest count was something like 16% food inflation. I mean, this is for people at the poorer end of the spectrum. They are obviously spending much more of their income on food, although I suppose the rich, they're swanking it around in the, you know, very most expensive restaurants and things like that. But this doesn't look as if it's going away. We've got the price of food is going up and up and up and up the whole time. So people are kind of, I mean, in a way, it doesn't surprise me that we've got this kind of increase in anxiety in society, because you're finding that your whatever your income is, from wherever it comes from, especially if you're on benefits, you're simply not able to get enough food on the table to feed yourself, feed your kids. And we're not talking about an expensive, lavish lifestyle here. We're just talking about enough to survive.
Well, yes, I know. I mean, it's crazy how much it's going up all the time, you know, the food. And I suppose because I'm doing more organic now, because I'm trying to turn my son's health around and treat him more with food, and stuff. So I just make a lot of things. But I've also had quite a big eye opener around a lot of the food in supermarkets isn't necessarily very good for you. Processed food and all the stuff that hidden sugars and salts and things. And because I was trying for my son to lose weight, so I just stopped buying all of that sort of thing, and I make things now. So, but then that's because I'm dedicating myself to my son.
Yeah.
And not everyone has that sort of dedication, perhaps. But
People often don't have the time to think. They just want to grab something quickly, stick it in the basket, get home. Maybe go to a takeaway or whatever. And our time is being robbed from us in many ways as well.
I think our time is, but sometimes I think, you know, in this very modern way of everything has to be fast food, fast this, so that you can get on with the real work of living. I'd wonder what is the real work if not looking after yourself and eating healthy things. And if you're going to get some fast food so that you can do something better than eat well, then I would wonder what that would be, because ultimately your health is everything.
I mean, it seems to me we should just ban non-organic food. I mean, might sound stupid.
No,
but you know, why should anybody buy a basket of lettuce or thing of lettuce from the I get these things from time to time from the supermarket, which has got a load of pesticides on it. I mean we had Georgina Downs on a few weeks ago, who runs this spray drift campaign, who says people just have no idea what pesticides are doing to us over a long period of time. You'll have a little bit every time you have you think you're having the lettuce to keep healthy, but if it's got pesticides on it, that can persist in your body for years, for decades, and eat away at your nervous system, you know. So if you've got MS, don't be too surprised if maybe you took a big lungful of spray drift when you were in your 30s or something. It could affect you all that way down the line. Is that practical, do you think? We could just say only organic? Is it really going to be that much more expensive?
In Cuba, because of the sanctions by the US and the collapse of the economy when the Soviet Union collapsed, they had to go organic because they couldn't do anything else. And they just turned everything over to grow. They grew all of the, they've made that transition. But they obviously are a unique, they've been under comprehensive economic sanctions since 1959, so they've had to do everything themselves their own way. So they developed their own vaccines, for example, for COVID, because nobody else was allowed to sell them any, so they had to develop their own.
Well, luckily we've got King Charles, who's the patron of the Soil Association. Only trouble is now he's king, he's signed into law this thing saying it's okay to genetically modify. We've now got a new law it's about 2 months ago signed into law saying, oh, you can just genetically modify whatever you want in terms of food to make it better. So he doesn't really seem to be sticking to his principle.
Well, I suppose he's the king now, so he can let those things go.
All the PR that got him there is now being forgotten about.
I think this GM crops thing is a very important issue. Because both the Russians have said that they are not going to have any GM in Russia. They're not going fully organic, but they're not going in for GM at all. They've got their own reasons for doing that. And, of course, the EU is very iffy about GM. But the Americans, of course, are gung-ho, which is why the British government, being the 53rd state, we're gung-ho for GM as well. But the Chinese were interested in GM. If people are interested in this, they read William Engdahl's stuff. But the Russians persuaded them not to go down that road. So this issue is becoming a sort of, and the problem, once you've got GM into the environment, you've it's there. You know, organic farmers in the US, if some GM seed flows over your land, which it might well do, on the wind
or pollen or whatever,
that means you're no longer organic, and you can't be certified as organic.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's why it's one or the other. But of course, Monsanto and the GM companies have pushed to get it in there. Let's just experiment with it and see what happens. Because once it's out there, nobody can tell when a bag of US rice arrives whether it's got a GM in or not. It may have some in, it may not. And once that happened, GM's in, GM just becomes normalised, and we're all just using GM. But of course, I think I can see, I don't want to be dogmatic about everything's got to be organic, Tony, but I think poor farmers generally are organic because they haven't got any money. I mean, in Poland, they were very organic because they couldn't afford fertiliser because of the changes that came in after the 1989, the farmers thought they were going to do rather well, when in actual fact they were smashed because the first thing that happened is all this frozen chicken arrived from the US in aeroplanes and, the prices collapsed and all the rest of it. They are one of the few last remaining individual peasantries in Europe. They've all got little plots. It's amazing to look at it, but they've had a very miserable time because they lost all their livestock, couldn't afford to keep them. They still use horses for ploughing, and a lot of it's like gardening, really. It's like gardening because they've got lots and lots of little plots. And I think it would be viable if you had the right policy. But the whole attitude of urban Poland is, well, this is just the past, we just get rid of it and move on. But of course, there's nothing for these people to do because unemployment in Eastern countries is actually quite high. That's why they're all come over here to work, because they can't get work at home. And I think all of these issues need a real, George Monbiot is provoking discussion about this, but his idea that we're going to produce everything in factories so that we can all, that we can rewild the wild, the food will be produced in factories and we'll all live in cities. I don't see that that's viable in many places.
This little quote I mentioned last week from the book was called The Countryside Explained in 1977 by John Seymour, who did the book about self-sufficiency. Just talks about a 400-acre farm which only used horses, no petrol, no tractors, because, of course, these tractors came along in World War II. As all the agricultural workers went on to fight, the Americans shipped a load of tractors over. Most farming before the Second World War was done with horses. And so if you just got the horses and the muck from the livestock, spread that over the land to help the you don't need any inputs at all, apart from people who live on the farm, working on the farm. All that happens is produce comes out of the farm. So I don't see why George would have a problem with that, as it's not causing any pollution. It's just supplying food, good organic food, for people to eat. Because in those days, there wasn't non-organic. It was all organic. So I'll try and dig out that quote from it. It's a fantastic quote. It was just a couple of paragraphs where he talks about this farm that still existed in the 1970s, where it was just horses and livestock that were fertilising the land. No chemicals whatsoever used, and no petrol inputs at all. They didn't even have, I think they may have just about had electricity in the farmhouse, but they weren't using hardly anything, just producing stuff. And that seems to me to be the way farming should be, Rita, don't you think?
Yeah, God, yes, I do. I really do. I suppose the other thing is as well, because I buy organic, but it's very, very, very expensive. Very, very, very expensive. I mean, I spend a fortune on food, as most of my money goes on food. And that is a shame, because, and then it makes you realise that good health is for the rich, really, not for the poor, because, of course, if you haven't got much money, you're going to be trotting down to Aldi's.
Yeah. But you tell the difference between an organic tomato and a non-organic tomato, you know, it's completely different. So make your salad with a bit of organic onion and tomato and you'll tell the difference. Anyway, look, we're going to get back to Bristol now. And as I mentioned at the start, there's this Bristol Unpacked podcast came out, I think it was just yesterday, actually, with Neil Maggs, one of my old colleagues from BCFM, interviewing Christine Townsend, who we used to have on the show quite a lot, Martin, as you remember. And after the Colston statue, she came in here talking about what happened there with Edward Colston. Now, the background to this really is the Merchant Venturers, who are this club who, we were told by their history professor from Bristol University that the same families that financed the trip to Newfoundland by John Cabot back in 1497 to so-called discover North America were, that once they realised what they found, and it was all kind of, well, I suppose it was not necessarily public at the time, they then formed this thing called the Society of the Merchant Venturers under a royal charter in the mid-1500s. And this society still exists today. They're very difficult to scrutinise because they don't fall under the normal things like the Companies Act. So you can't have a look at their accounts. You can't have a look at their membership. In fact, it's quite feasible that there are members of the Merchant Venturers that they don't put on their website are members of the Merchant Venturers. You could do a little bit as a journalist, tracking them down, whoever they are, by seeing which boards of which companies they appear on. So if you see a Merchant Venturer popping up on a board of a London newspaper, for example, you know that they are most probably own so many shares in that paper and they've been able to nominate that person onto the board. But otherwise, it's very difficult to track what they do. Christine Townsend talking to Neil Maggs in his podcast yesterday, I'll put a full version of this up on our show page as part of this thing called the Bristol Cable that used to be upstairs in this building, then moved out. The Bristol Cable is a monthly, or is it, I think, maybe bi-monthly newspaper produced here in Bristol. Not quite as good as the Bristolian, but it tries. And so let's have a listen now to her talking to Neil Maggs about the pre-slave trade era. Who were the families that formed the Merchant Venturers? What were they up to?
They were quite happy to round up orphans and, you know, before sort of getting into the enslavement of Africans. Mm. It was paupers, criminals, or people they would consider to be criminals, prostitutes, whoever, that the kind of they'd be quite happy to deport people to enslave them.
Yeah.
So it was, but that narrative's not going to come out when you're wanting to present somebody that was, you know, paternalistic and philanthropic and sort of had all this philanthropy and look what a great guy he was.
You're not and the church being, you know, Bristol Cathedral and you know, Redcliffe Church. I recently had Reverend Phil Knott, who's got a new role at Bristol Cathedral on the show, and they're very much trying to, you know, he's relatively new, but he's very much trying to become a sort of progressive, forward-thinking institution and stuff like that. The church in Bristol, really, the high church in Bristol, massively colluded with that story, didn't they?
Of course they did. Of course they did. Well, the bishop was repeating it to the children in the cathedral. You know,
which, for those that don't know, and then I think the show that you spoke at the beginning used to be on, I think the journalist Tony Goslin went in secretly and recorded some speech, didn't he, which was then put out.
What kicked it all off for me, really. I was just like, what is this? Because by that time, you see, the schools that were in there, apart from the Colston School, which is still private, the other hundreds of children were from state schools run by the Merchant Venturers. And I was like, these are state schools. This is now everybody's business.
Yeah.
Because this is their educational practice. And they've got a Bishop of Bristol in an 11th century cathedral telling children that Colston was a brilliant bloke and talking about Colston and Jesus Christ in the same sentence.
And Colston and Jesus Christ on a really deep, slightly sinister level, the whole eating of the bun being very much like the Eucharist, you know, the body of Christ. Do you know what I mean? A little bit on some sort of weird subliminal level that impact that would have.
Of course.
You know?
And complicit to see that you're teaching children to be complicit, that would cause them to be conflicted with what they're doing.
Fantastic. That was sent to me. I didn't realise that was in that clip, was a little bit of mention of me as well, which is rather sweet. I went into, with Tim Herford, the musician, went into Bristol Cathedral to try to, not spy on them, but just to record what was being said in there. Now, it is extraordinary, Martin, isn't it, that the Merchant Venturers can kind of block book Bristol Cathedral for the day, exclude everybody else, including the normal people that might want to go to a service that day, and then preach to these kids in their own academies that they now run that any connection with the slave trade to Edward Colston is just pure speculation, which is what the bishop said in the sermon.
Well, this is what's Founders Day, it's called, and Colston Girls School and Colston Boys School used to go every year on Founders Day to Bristol Cathedral, and they would be given a bun and they would be told what a wonderful philanthropist Edward Colston was, because he found, you know, he gave them money to found these private schools.
It's like almost like Colston's bread, isn't it? Like Jesus's bread or whatever.
Well, that's right, as they were saying in the clip.
Sick.
As they were saying in the clip. Now, what Christine was saying, and of course she used to be a secondary school teacher, and she's a campaigner on educational issues in the first place when I first knew her, and you first knew her, and what's happened is that the Merchant Venturers, because of the academies programme pursued by both Tory and Labour governments, the merchant venturers have come out of retirement to sort of take over Bristol schools. They've got to, you know, in the past they wouldn't have been allowed to run schools. They're not. Why would they be an appropriate organisation to run schools?
Sorry, we're so sorry that you don't have any money. Well, we seem to have quite a lot of money. Would you like us to take over?
I think the ideology behind it was because they got these private schools in their pocket, and no doubt when the private schools went in there, they got told that Colson was indeed a wonderful chap, and that slavery would. You see what Christine's picking up on there. These are state school pupils who are being lectured by the merchant ventures indirectly through Bishop Mike that Colston, in fact, is a wonderful philanthropist, and the idea that he was involved in slavery is just speculation, is what he recorded him saying. Which, of course, he was then forced to defend on BBC Radio Bristol and found quite difficult to defend.
It was a bit of a bonus because Tim Pemberton, who was West Indian, was the managing editor of Radio Bristol at the time. So when I came out of the cathedral, I said, you'll never guess what I just heard in there, Tim. Well, I mean, and another side to this story was that they did try and kick Tim and I out of the cathedral. We were sitting down there innocently looking, waiting to enjoy the service, and they actually held the service up before we'd been ejected from the cathedral. So a lady came over and said, hey, where can I see your tickets, please? And so I said, well, you know, we've been invited, and I haven't got my ticket and whatever. And then she went away, and she came back a couple of minutes later. Everyone was sort of looking at us like, well, we can only start once these two have been gotten rid of. And so, I mean, this is how they run it. And so as Tim and I were walking out, one of the vergers at the back of the cathedral says, OK, you can come and sit here and watch it. So actually really sweet. He obviously, the people who were working at the theatre weren't really happy about the fact that they were throwing people out of the service. Mm. And in fact, I've never, ever known a service like that in the cathedral where people would be ejected. And so I sat there, I just put my phone up and started recording it. And then the rest is history. But this is an organisation now, Martin, which is in control of many of our public utilities that Thatcher privatised. They now own and run them, and so every time you switch your tap on or turn the light on, the merchant venturers get their cut.
Well, if you remember, the only merchant venturer that ever came on the show,
Chris Curling. Yeah. Curling. He was the master.
And they never used to have any publicity at all. They liked everything to be very, very, very quiet. But he agreed to come on because he'd just been elected or appointed to be the head of it, and he came to the old studio we used to have at City Academy, and he said, as luck wouldn't have it, from his point of view, Bristol Water that morning had just received the stiffest fine ever for overcharging people, and he was on the board of Bristol Water. So he came in and he said, and of course it was the news of the day, you've just been massively fined for overcharging people, what do you have to say about that? And of course, he was very eager.
A corporate lawyer, wasn't he?
He was a corporate lawyer. He said, well, I'll tell you what's going to happen with that. My job on the board, I'm a lawyer. We're going to appeal against this. And he didn't say using all the money we've made, although you can put that in your, you know, because we made a load of money doing this. And we're going to use that money to appeal, and we will succeed.
And he did.
And guess what? Yeah. They did.
Yeah, so they kept the money and they kept the price increase.
What Christine's particularly concerned about, and so am I, and I've worked in various schools in Bristol because I get moved around, is the merchant venturers have decided that they're going to go into education in a big way. But they're not, to my mind, they're not... This is what happened in the US when they said, we've got to get rid of all these state-run schools run by local authorities with democratic control and all this. Let's let some new people have a go. And in Chicago, the first two organisations that put their hands up to run a school was McDonald's and the US Marine Corps.
Oh, Christ.
Yeah, well, that's what charter schools means in the US.
Actually, the merchants were working.
Now, I would argue, as an old-fashioned comprehensive school chap with parents who worked in comprehensive schools, that's not right. McDonald's and the US Marine Corps are not suitable people to run schools, and possibly the merchant venturers aren't suitable people to run schools either. I mean, I don't, you know, what skills have they got apart from running the private schools, which they set up years and years ago?
Well,
but they don't actually run
them. They've got their own spin on affairs, which is a little bit of a far right one. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to the final clip from that podcast. As I say, I'll put the full version up on our show page, which is a fascinating version into the sort of Bristol Illuminati, these weird guys that basically feel like they own the place. In fact, to a large extent, they do own lots of the land and the property. The merchant venturers, what are they, who are the merchant venturers?
It's a private members group, but the people that they bring in as an organisation are they're either non-exec directs or they're kind of chief exec, very, very senior people within all of the really important areas of the economy and society. So they've got top level people on NHS boards, for example.
Yeah.
They've people from the top level university, but they've also got lawyers, people that would be working in the finance industry, are very kind of involved in that. They've all, you know, this youth zone that's in South Bristol.
Yeah.
So they've recently brought in somebody from one of the organizations involved in running those youth zones. So they're very skilled and they're very savvy about who it is they're inviting in to make sure that they're all part of their club as well.
Actually, it sounds like a kind of shadow government, Martin, really. I mean, they're sitting in the background owning various things, and now they're saying, well, actually, we're going to be framing the minds of our young people.
Well, for many centuries, they were the government of the city. It's only the democratic struggles of the ordinary people in Bristol which have gradually created an elected council. They were the only people in charge at one stage. There used to be a franchise, and you had to be a merchant to vote. And that's how it was run. And it was true of lots of places, but Bristol in particular. And of course, over the years, that's gradually been diluted. But in actual fact, behind the scenes, they still, for example, all of the property development in Bristol, they've got a finger in all of that.
These are the people that won the Civil War, aren't they? The merchant classes decided to get very well organised after the English Civil War, saying, actually, it's all really about us and trade. And, hopefully all the wealth will trickle down a little bit anyway to the peasants. In fact, they've got a motto up on their Merchant Venturers Hall on the promenade in Latin. If you translate it, it says, "The poor are stupid and will suffer much." If you translate it.
Yes, that is, I believe, that is their motto.
So there
they
you
don't
go.
Boast about that. Though,
anyway, Rita, maybe there's a song in that. Who knows? Anyway, so we'll finish with your song. It's called Your Illusion. Do you want to just say a little bit about that before we say goodbye?
Oh, yes, my song Illusion is on an album called What Am I? And it's with myself and John Langley. And,
The other John Langley.
The other John Langley.
Okay, well, can you say a little bit about what it's about?
It's basically about, I suppose, being in the resistance and going against the powers that be and finding and hoping for, you know, a better time, a revolution.
Brilliant. Well, that's absolutely really appropriate, because when it comes to break time in about half an hour, we've got a song by Biss called The Teensy Revolution. So it's revolutionary stuff today. Thanks ever so much for joining us, Rita Lynch.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So that is Illusion, 2010 album from Rita Lynch, who just joined us there. Martin, we're going to talk a little bit now about Boris and about Donald Trump. But first of all, Boris. So you texted me after the show last week, the dog is dead. Actually, they used to call him Big Dog, didn't they?
That's right, the Big Dog is dead.
Yeah, yes. So he's gone. And, I mean, it certainly doesn't look to me as if there's going to be any kind of comeback anytime soon. The Privileges Committee have quite cleverly been pressing his buttons to get him so annoyed that he's going to resign as an MP. Well, actually, he might have actually been able to be more successful as an annoying backbencher, chewing away like a little terrier on Richie Sunak's ankle, but now he's decided to go.
Well, I mean, obviously this is a developing story as we speak.
Is it?
Yes, because...
No, he's off.
No, because we're talking about the various people who've resigned, and Nadine Dorries said she was going to resign, but she hasn't resigned yet, so she's trying to make as much difficulty for Sunak as possible. So
I thought the Labour Party did this sort of thing. Their little internecine squabbles.
Well, listen, political parties, especially under first past the post, are broad coalitions, and therefore you've got plenty of scope for people to fall out with each other about the direction of policy or whatever. I mean, one of the things that Boris Johnson said is, "When's Rishi Sunak going to cut taxes?" And you feel like saying, "Yes, that's what Liz Truss tried to do and crash the economy, you fool." Why would they say that?
They always say it because they know in all the surveys that the Tories love to vote for the idea of cutting taxes, and this is just the one hot button issue that they will all vote for.
Exactly,
so they say
they even
whether
got
they
it.
Can or not. If they just say that, then they'll get votes.
The problem
in
is
the opinion
poll, Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz. Liz, I think he said Liz Hurley. There, that's talking about ex celebrities. Liz Truss. Were basically, they did that. They said we're going to give unfunded tax cuts to wealthy people. And the problem with that is that the markets tanked and the pension funds nearly went down the drain and the Bank of England had to restart quantitative easing and so on. Because there's no scope, really, for cutting taxes for wealthy people in this country, at least for a generation, and probably never. Don't forget, they were all bailed out in 2008. If the government hadn't stepped in to bail the banks out, they'd have lost everything.
But they shouldn't be moaning about they've got to pay more taxes. I'm quite certain that the Marlborough Conservative Party will be chit-chatting through the weekend about all this, thinking, well, actually, this is really just an attack on Brexit, isn't it? Sunak never was really a Brexiteer. He wants to rejoin the single market, possibly, and anyway, he doesn't really care. He's just in there to lose the next election, and so Starmer will get in. And so there's a lot of Tories who are individual members of the party who, for example, voted for Boris, certainly didn't vote for Sunak in the leadership election when Boris was booted out. But this is something which will go down quite well with the media. It may well go down well in Westminster, but actually with the Tory membership, they're going to be livid.
The Tory membership is going to be, it's going to be livid. There's only 80,000 of them, as you know. And they're going to be livid because they can't be satisfied whatever happens. And in any
case, they can, because
they
look, there is one major factor. You see, I mean, I know you're a Labour Party member, Martin, but the main problem is that Boris did an absolutely amazing job in winning the 2019 election with his 80 seat majority. Mm-hmm. Whether or not, I mean, we all know that the system is rigged to a certain extent, but it's still a thumping majority. And Sunak is way down in the polls. If anyone is going to win the next election for the Tories, it's going to be Boris, not Rishi Sunak. And Rishi Sunak is going to lose it. So it's almost as if you will be delighted, of course, but the Tory party has just managed to shoot itself in the head.
Well, they've done quite a lot of that lately, haven't they? I think the problem for the Tory party is that what they really need to do if they want to have any chance of winning the next election is they've got to unite behind the Prime Minister they've got. Now, if they're not prepared to do that, and it's quite clear some people aren't, I mean, Nigel Farage was saying, why don't he and Boris campaign against the Tories at the next election? And that really is manna to my ears, because that will split the Tory vote. All the Marlborough Tories would vote for Boris and Nigel, and then the Labour Party might take Marlborough. You see, that's how it works. In Northern Ireland, they understand these things.
I mean,
they're
we
much
didn't
more tribal.
Really hear. I mean, the difference between Trump and Boris is that we haven't really heard hardly anything from Boris at all, apart from his letters. So if this was was in the States, he would be all over the press. He'd be
he's all over the press
meeting.
Here.
No, Martin, you just completely ignore what I said. He's the face and the voice of Boris. Is not all over the place. Whereas Trump is in the States. He doesn't do that. What he's done is he's released these statements, and he's got various people who are kind of out there speaking for him. I will put copies of his two statements that he's made. He made a resignation letter and then a statement yesterday when it became clear the actual evidence that the Privileges Committee had put forward against him. He says, I've received a letter from the Privileged Committee making it clear, much to my amazement, that they are determined to use the proceedings against me to drive me out of Parliament. Well, they hadn't actually done that, Boris. I mean, they were going to suspend you for 90 days. That doesn't mean driving you out of Parliament, does it? It means you've just got to stay and, you can come back in a little while. They've still not produced a shred of evidence that I knowingly or recklessly misled the Commons. They know perfectly well that when I spoke to in the Commons, I was saying what I believed sincerely to be true and to what I have been briefed to say, like other ministers. They know that I corrected the record as soon as possible, and they know that every other senior official and minister, including the current Prime Minister and then occupant of the same building, Rishi Sunak, believed that we were working lawfully together. So, I mean, you can see his point of view. I mean, you're happy to see him go, but he's talked about it as a kangaroo court, and it does certainly seem to be something like that with Harriet Harman in charge of it. Also, you know, it's no proper judicial procedure, is it, to have her moaning about how he's guilty before the inquest has even started into whether he is or not. So, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why he's got. This is really just about Brexit, though, isn't it?
No, it isn't.
They want the Remainers just want Boris out because he was the one that got Brexit done.
No, it isn't. Bernard Jenkin, who Boris Johnson suggests should be sacked from the select committee because he supposedly broke lockdown rules. He was a very firm Brexiteer. I think lots of the people who are on firmly in favour of Brexit in the Tory party have had enough of Boris Johnson because he smashed their vote amongst elderly people by the lockdown parties during lockdown. That was very, very, very unpopular. And if you look out at the opinion polls now, you will see that the vast majority of British people think he was lying, he is lying, and they want him to go. So he ain't going to win any 80-seat majority for him. And those people who think he is are going to sink their own party at the next election and give Keir Starmer an overall majority. Now, I'm a bit ambivalent about that. I don't necessarily want Starmer to have an overall majority. So, you know, be careful what you wish for. But if they do go down the road of attacking their own side, which is what they're intending to do, under a first-past-the-post system, they'll be smashed. That's what will happen to them. And maybe they'll be out for a generation that damn well should be.
You would say that as a Labour Party member, but the whole point surely here is to go back into the single market. This is what's eventually going to happen.
That's not going to be an issue at the next election. Some people think it should be.
No. Look, Martin, I'm not saying that. See, you're just talking over me and ignoring my point. This is not going to be a campaigning issue, but it's going to happen, surely.
All right, well, there's two things there. First of all, it will be a campaigning issue in Scotland and in Wales, because Plaid Cymru and the SNP are quite clear they want the same deal as Northern Ireland. They want to be back in the single market. Okay? So that's what they
will. We know how corrupt Plaid Cymru are.
I'm just saying that it will be an issue.
The SNP. All right, okay. That's not exactly an argument.
Maybe they're all corrupt in whatever way.
I mean, you want them back. Just, why do you want them back in the single market? Right, or Britain? Why should Britain go back into the single market?
Let's come back to the substantial point about the single market. We are the only country in the whole of Europe that is not in the single market by directly or indirectly. The purpose of this is so that we can diverge our standards of size of screws and all these other things from what everybody else is doing. I put it to you, Tony, why do you think that's going to be any good for the British economy at all? It's clearly not, and the evidence is piling up. And at some point, we will be forced back into the single market because it's the only option. But nobody can talk about it in case people who voted for Brexit get upset. But they're a minority, and ultimately the minority will lose.
The majority voted for Brexit.
No, not now. Not in 2023, Tony.
Oh, especially after all those people died of COVID, the old people.
Yeah. That's right. And the young people never wanted to leave the European Union. And they're ultimately going to inherit this country when you and me are both gone,
Tony. And do the young people know what they're talking about?
No, they
should
don't.
Should we have loads of, like, 15, 16-year-old MPs?
I think 16-year-olds should vote. That's like what's in Wales, happened, in actually, Scotland and Wales, 16-year-olds will be voting.
What has happened is I'm not trying to defend these politicians, but, you know, I would rather have older people in politics rather than young people. It's the same in journalism. I think what we've seen over the last 30, 40 years is some of the experienced people moved out, and these young whippersnappers coming in, because they're just blatantly ambitious. How do they know what I saw? He says, this is Boris Johnson writing in his letter of response to the Partygate report yesterday. What retinal impressions have they somehow discovered that are completely unavailable to me? I saw no goings on at all in the press room or at home that I can remember, certainly nothing illegal. As the committee has heard, officials are heavily engaged in preparing difficult messaging about the prospect of a no-deal Brexit and a Christmas lockdown. It is a measure of the committee's desperation that they're trying incompetently and absurdly to tie me to an illicit event with an argument so threadbare it belongs in one of Bernard Jenkins' nudist colonies. Now, he's obviously a good writer. He can think on his feet a bit when he does a speech as well. But he's gone out of political... even though the British people voted for him back in 2019, for right or wrong, he's been cast out into the outer darkness, hasn't he?
Well, what's happened here is that he's ignoring the fact that the police fined everybody, so they were guilty. So the committee doesn't even have to look into that.
Is it Boris's job to look into the minutiae of all the rules and things?
No, it's
his chief of staff or something's job to do that, isn't it?
You seem determined to defend
him.
Why
have they just got... What about Tony Blair? I mean, he lied to Parliament. He caused an illegal war. He was not sanctioned at all, was he?
No, and the problem is it's about politics, Tony. Tony Blair was a survivor, Boris Johnson isn't, and Boris Johnson's problems are largely personal. He's actually arrogant.
They've changed
he's
a lot.
He's very arrogant,
they've
and
changed,
that's why he's ended up where he's ended
a lot
up.
Of the procedures, and this whole privileges committee is relatively new. Anyway, one of Boris's defenders, a chap called Jacob Rees-Mogg, a local MP here, he was talking to, I think it was Sky News, yesterday, and explaining why he thinks that really this is just simply a kangaroo court run by Harriet Harman that's gotten rid of Boris.
I have read the report carefully, and there are a couple of things that might be worth highlighting. One is that they seem to think they can get into Boris Johnson's mind and find him guilty of misleading because they think they know what he was thinking. So when he goes upstairs, they think that he must have noticed. Well, they have no evidence for that. That's just a supposition. I'd also say that I was Leader of the House at the time, and I was briefed for business questions to answer why a party is going on. And the briefing I was given, the line to take, was exactly the same as the Prime Minister's, and that is that the rules were followed at all times, with emphasis on all times. So I think they have come to conclusions that are not fully supported by the evidence. And there's one very interesting thing. If you look at the back, look at Appendix 3, they make a response to the comments Mr. Johnson makes and what they think he should have said. But they leave out, they don't respond to the key point he makes about Harriet Harman's position. It's Appendix 1. Appendix 1 and Appendix 3 is Johnson's statement. And they say, they go through all Johnson's questions in his letter of the 9th of June, but they ignore this key point which they fail to answer. And that seems to me to be just as serious as some of the things they accuse Boris Johnson of. They answer selectively. They don't answer that fundamental point, chairman who had expressed her view prior to the case.
So, Jacob, it seems that kind of the kind of guardrails, if you like, or the lines are set in this, and that Boris Johnson supporters are not going to be moved to find another position on the findings of this report. But just to be clear before we move on, when it comes to Harriet Harman, you believe that if she had recused herself, the committee would have had more legitimacy?
Oh, definitely. If you had found a Labour MP who had made no comment about Boris Johnson, that would have established a committee with considerably more authority. And look what Chris Bryant did. Chris Bryant recused himself because he had done what Harriet Harman had also done.
I imagine many of your colleagues in the Commons will be shouting at the television at this point, saying it was a 14th month investigation. It was asked for by the House of Commons. It was a cross-party committee. They have studied so much evidence and they have come to this conclusion. Ooh. And that by criticising it, you and Boris Johnson and his supporters are undermining the undermining the legitimacy of democratic institutions. Many people might
think
that.
First of all, who drafts the report that a committee agrees? It's the chairman. They vote on the chairman's draft. The influence of the chairman is fundamental to select committees. And the idea that you can't criticise select committee reports or their operations is absurd. The House of Commons used to try and be very precious about its privilege and called John Junior to the bar of the House, and it makes itself look foolish when it is precious about privilege.
Let me put it another way to you, Sir Jacob, because you like process. Was it right for Boris Johnson to basically breach confidentiality, having been given a copy of the report, by on Friday resigning and effectively revealing some of, not the detail of the report, but
that's the key point.
Do you think he should have done that?
You qualify yourself quite rightly. You say effectively. He didn't reveal the details of the report. He obeyed the confidentiality, but he decided...
They say that he breached it.
They say that by deciding to resign, he breached it. But they can't point to any individual item where he's breached it. But you've been listening to the radio and to the media, and you will no doubt have heard journalists say sources close to the committee have told them. That is a breach of privilege. If any member of the committee or clerk of the committee has briefed a journalist anonymously, that is a breach of privilege. And I think they should take the mote out of their own eye, the beam out of their own eye, before trying to take the mote out of Boris Johnson's.
Okay. So, Jacob, it seems to me that the report is out, and really the positions were set before the report is out, and it's not really changing the narrative around Boris Johnson.
I think there's one thing that's changed, and that this is this 90-day suspension, which is extraordinary. I think it shows that the report is deliberately trying to do damage to Boris Johnson. It is way beyond a judicial sanction. Very few people have got sanctions of this kind for sometimes the most serious offences.
He was the Prime Minister, and the committee has found that multiple contempts of Parliament. He was the Prime Minister. Does that not mean that his sanction should be greater because of the responsibility he bore?
For most of the contempts, they find he wasn't Prime Minister. They find most of the contempts about how he responded to them, which I think when you're defending yourself, to say, well, we don't agree with the way you've defended yourself, is a very odd way of proceeding. But no, I think their fundamental judgment is wrong, because I don't think he deliberately misled Parliament, and I think he tried to correct the record when he could, and there's good evidence for that. But I think the 90-day sanction shows more than perhaps the committee would like to show.
And what about his pass being revoked?
That was trivial. I mean, that's just so it's like switching off a child's Nintendo 10 minutes early.
Well, that would be very serious in my house if I dare do that, to be honest.
So, yes, Jacob Rees-Mogg defending Boris Johnson. I mean, the guy did win the biggest majority for the Tories for 40 years, and yet he's been booted out by a Harriet Harman-run committee, which is, well, I mean, as Rees-Mogg is pointing out there, is actually judging him for misdemeanours that they were committing themselves by leaking stuff to the press.
All right. We could go into all the details about whether he's been badly
this
treated.
This is a sort of quasi-judicial committee, isn't it, that's been set up here?
No, it isn't. We haven't got a constitution in this country. There isn't
yes,
a written
Yes, it is a quasi-judicial
yes,
committee.
Yes, it's a quasi-judicial
so committee. So don't say no, it isn't, then.
It is a quasi-judicial committee because we haven't got a constitution, Tony. And the select committees of the Houses of Parliament. Now, there's going to be a vote on this on Monday.
Yeah.
And it'll be very interesting to see who votes for what.
Yes, because
all of the opposition will vote
the Tories,
in favour.
The Tories.
And the Tories will split.
The Tories, I don't know that they'll split that much because they'll all be looking for jobs from Rishi.
They will. And it may well be that the faction on the right of the party is increasingly disliked by the mainstream.
So he
because
makes
they're not team players, Tony.
Old Boris makes several claims, doesn't he, both in his resignation letter and in his response to the Select Committee report yesterday. He said it's very sad to be leaving Parliament, at least for now. Is there any possibility, do you think, of a resurgence of Boris?
Well, Nigel Farage has already said that he and Boris could stand together to get Brexit
so
done.
Do you see, is any of this going to happen, do you think? Is that the end of Boris?
No, if he does, personally,
I don't think we're going to see him again. I think he's been absolutely...
I think it's likely that he's going to go off and make a load of money.
No, I mean, in Parliament.
Oh, indeed,
he says,
yeah.
I'm leaving Parliament, at least for now.
It's quite likely that Rishi Sunak and others will say, no, he can't stand. Because what he's angling for is when Nadine Dorries' seat comes up, he was thinking, well, maybe I could get in there. Yeah? Now, if he does that, that's going to mess up Rishi Sunak's election strategy completely. So, of course, Keir Starmer and Sir Ed Davey are rubbing their hands about that.
Are these by-elections really any problem for Sunak?
They will be a problem for the Tory party because they're going to lose them. And then they'll have a panic saying, well, maybe we need to get rid of Sunak in the way that you're suggesting. But, of course, that means a whole nother big bun fight as the country goes down the drain. Because don't forget, the Ukraine war is escalating. The cost of living crisis hasn't ended. There's possibly going to be a banking collapse. And meanwhile, the Tories are arguing who they want in number 10 Downing Street. The rest of what's happening now, you can see, if you look at the opinion polls, the majority of people have made up their mind about this. They don't want him back. And if the Tory party was trying to bring him back, they would lose the election. There's no doubt about that. They'd be smashed completely. They've got a better chance with Rishi, but even so, because of all this, people are beginning to think they're all a shower. And they're right. They are all a shower.
Well, yes, on both sides. But definitely on both sides. One of the things that the new government pledged straight away, that is under Rishi Sunak, was that they were going to stop the boat crossings. Of course, they haven't. And there's been this horrific tragedy in the Mediterranean as well this week, where it looks as if a Greek Coast Guard vessel was towing a migrant boat, which then caused it to capsize. And hundreds of people are dead as a result. This is organised crime trafficking, these people, Martin, but you seem to think it's OK.
I don't think it's OK, Tony. I don't think we should have invaded Iraq or Libya or any of these countries. We should have minded our own business. But we didn't. And we have a responsibility here in Britain, where the British Empire created all of this mess. We've got a responsibility to mop our
British,
mess up.
The British didn't create all this mess, did they?
They did. We invaded Iraq, Tony. Do you remember?
This is organised crime.
No, organised crime feeds on chaos created by other organised criminals in the banks and the deep state in the West. They've manipulated everything to do with this.
Did you see, by the way, that I think it was the UN were criticising the European Union, saying that you shouldn't be allowing this kind of boats to go across because you're not actually doing anything to stop the boats going across. And we're talking about a lot of people dying in the Mediterranean. We're not talking here about the Channel today.
No. In other words, the Channel's a sideshow. But you wouldn't think that to listen to Nigel Farage and all these other people who are all in favour of invading
and
Iraq.
Let me just remind you how in favour they were. I think this is very silly, you trying to link it all to Iraq. It's nothing to do with that at the moment. UK population to well over 80 million, apparently, by 2046, with all these migrants.
Well, what they've promised is that they were going to...
Is most of these migrants coming across on the British Empire chickens coming home to roost?
It certainly is, in some respects. Yes, it certainly is. The other thing...
No, it's organised crime trafficking.
Most of these people coming in are legal immigrants. Yeah? The ones that are coming in, even the ones in the boats are legal, they're just trying to claim asylum. The asylum system's broke because they're trying to deter people from claiming it, but lots of people are going to claim it whether you like it or not. So if you promise your Tory voters that you're going to stop it, you've got to have a plan to stop it. In actual fact, you can't because the world's actually in a chaotic state, Tony. Millions of people have fled from the Ukraine. Did you notice any of that? Did any of that sink in? The Hong Kong Chinese are going to turn up. They'll all have to go to Liverpool, won't they? That's where they've got a community.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. There is a lot of chaos around. Record net migration, the rising demand for housing is a report out last week. If net migration to the UK is allowed to continue at the present record level of 606,000 per year, the UK population is projected to grow by more than 15 million by 2046, far surpassing the level of 80 million before the mid-century. It's estimated that this would result in the need to build between 6 and 8 million more homes, equal to between 15 and 18 more cities the size of Birmingham. So this is having an effect on our housing crisis too, isn't it?
Yeah, and I tell you, a nuclear war will have an even bigger effect. All of these things are linked. The increase.
It's a distraction, really.
No, it's not
saying,
a distraction, yeah. Tony. You
what
want it to be
housing?
About channel
this is,
crossings?
No. This is about population right. and housing. And a major effect on our housing market and the housing bubble and the housing crisis and the homelessness crisis and the number of people being evicted increasing all the time because interest rates are going up is also partly because the population is projected to grow by more than 15 million. This is just because, literally, because Rishi Sunak and his chums have promised to do something about all these extra migrants coming into the country, and they've done almost nothing.
Because they can't. When they went to negotiate with the Indians about having a trade deal, now that we've left the EU, Tony, what Narendra Modi told them is you've got to open up your universities to our young people, and they've got to be allowed to stay with their families at the end of that. Most of these migrants who are coming in are actually skilled migrants, because they've got rid of all the people
who
used to work in the shops.
Not, they don't really have the political will to do this, because they have other political priorities, like trade deals. That's what you're saying.
Yes.
So I'll put a link up to this record net migration and the rising demand for housing report on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I think it makes for fascinating reading. I think we've just got to be realistic about having to build 15 million new homes.
Yes, we'll have to be realistic
about it. We ain't doing anything like that.
No, we're not. And of course, as the Third World War develops, Tony, people are going to find there's a lot of discomfort involved in it. And they should have thought about that before they set off on the direction they
went. I don't think it's just the Third World War. It's also things like increasing interest rates, increasing
food prices. There's going to be a financial collapse
and a world
war.
Sanctions on the Russians. Well, that was a really stupid thing to do because it just blew back. But actually, maybe a lot of people have made money out of that.
They have, and that's why they keep on doing these things, Tony. Because after this whole crisis from 2001 to 2008 to today has made the very wealthy super wealthy. So it's not been a problem for them at all. It's the ordinary people of all countries who've paid the price. But there's going to be a global revolution. The Russians and the Chinese used to be the communist powers. They're not the old communist powers of before, but they are the opposition.
Meanwhile,
and they're going to help the opposition to the West in every country to make sure that the West loses its death grip on their countries.
Well, that doesn't look like it's going to be the death grip is going to be lasting that long, at least with the death gripper Biden in charge. I don't know if you heard this clip from a couple of days ago, one of the speeches he gave, Martin, where he's saying that the United States is planning to build a railroad from the Pacific across the Indian Ocean. Did you hear that?
I didn't hear it, but I presume that that's the sort of thing he says.
Well, we're going to win and we're going to help. We have plans to build a railroad from the Pacific all the way across the Indian Ocean. We have plans to build in Angola, one of the largest solar plants in the world. I can go on, but I'm not. I'm going off script. I'm going to get in trouble.
Definitely going off script there. I don't know if it's possible to build a railroad across the Indian Ocean. What is he thinking about?
Well, what he's doing is they're trying to down, you know, diss the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative and all the rest of it, because the Chinese are saying, look, we've got realistic plans here to upgrade all of your infrastructure.
But is he going to have floating sleepers for his...
Well, I mean, the problem with Biden, as you well know, is he's not actually all there. Nor was Ronald Reagan, nor was George W. Bush. It's normal in the United States to have somebody in charge. Even Trump they don't actually run it. Yeah, in Russia, Putin is in charge. He's not a dictator in the way that people say. He's primus inter pares. He's the elected president. He has to work within the system.
Anyway, we're going to be hearing at 7.
In the US, it's just not the case.
We're hoping to link up at 7 with Don DeBar in the US to get his take on what's happening with Donald Trump's prosecution this week. And I've got a clip of Donald speaking at all places in Bedminster, which is one of the parts of South Bristol, which Christine Townsend, I think, is one of the councillors for, incidentally. But we'll leave that. We'll leave the clip until we get Don on the line. In between times, as I said last week, there's a few clips or a few interviews I did at the Better Way conference the weekend before last in Bath, which was a terrific event. Actually, a few sort of Trojan horses in there too. It seemed to me that there were people who were kind of piggybacking on this kind of alternative, I suppose that's what you'd expect really, alternative health movement to peddle their own wares. One of the really sensible people I spoke to is an acupuncturist called Sarah Kibble.
I obviously make sure that they realise that I am not giving them medical advice. I'm not telling them to stop their medication. And my aim is to support them in that process, if they want to reduce Western meds, that can be possible in conjunction with my treatment. It's about them having informed choices that there are other options beyond big pharma drugs for me.
Now, there's a lot of talk about big pharma. What's the real problem with them?
They're in it for the money. And they don't care about the side effects, because we know that they keep vast amounts of money aside for court cases, because they know people are going to sue them for the side effects of their drugs, and we know that they don't care about that. Whereas holistic practitioners like myself and like the people that Dr. Teslori is working with, we're trying to empower everyone. That's our vision, and that's why I've got involved with this organization, because we're trying to get people to take responsibility for their own health and not rely on what big pharma's telling them they should or shouldn't do.
Well, it's a great shame, isn't it? That's Sarah Kibble there, who's an acupuncturist in Bath. They're saying people have got to take responsibility for their own health. Well, you can understand that, but, you know, back in the good old days, we used to trust doctors to tell us what was wrong with us and what we should do best. And now it seems that the pharmaceutical industry has gotten into the minds of the doctors and is almost like puppeteers, steering what the doctors say and think in order for them to be able to make more money out of our fact that we get ill.
Yes, I totally agree. Big Pharma are bad actors in every possible way. And, of course, it's very advanced in the United States, where the whole thing really is just done for money. And there's no attempt to disguise.
Yeah, the idea is to get you hooked on some sort of treatment.
The profit motive.
Get you hooked on some sort of treatment, which is a direct debit every week or every month until the day you die. That seems to be their objective. So one of the best people I spoke to, another good person, was a woman called Nikki Shepherd from the EMF Protection Group.
5G and EMF shielding is, is a huge narrative at the moment. Everybody's interested in how to improve their health, so it's a perfect alignment with the conference. And from speakers to delegates, we've had so many interesting conversations with people about improving their EMF exposure, either at home or in their clinics. So what we want to do is educate practitioners, but everybody really, how to spot electrosensitivity in patients and how to educate patients on EMF exposure, how to measure it, which meters to use, you know, what different types of EMF exposure there is, and break it down step by step so that people understand, you know, what we're dealing with here, and deal with these chronic so-called autoimmune issues that are on the rise.
I mean, the main problem is you can't see this stuff, so how do you detect it? And how, the two questions, how do you detect EMF, and how do you know if you've got a medical problem which may be being caused by either mobile data networks, Wi-Fi, or some other kind of electro smog? Firstly, the first one is, how do you know?
You know, well, what we do is we encourage people to educate themselves and use meters. So there are different types of meters for different types of exposures.
But what are the sorts of ailments that might be caused by this? So you can at first at least get a clue as to whether it might be being caused by EMF.
Well, typical symptoms might be, and I'm talking about myself as well because I've had the experience, would be chronic fatigue, quite severe sleep issues, or people that say they sleep okay but they wake up exhausted. Brain fog is another big one. That's a huge symptom in the electrosensitivity arena. And then there are other things like digestive issues. So certain frequencies can cause certain symptoms in the body. So for one, it might be migraines. For another person, it might be IBS issues. And the problem is people don't associate those so-called everyday symptoms with something they've just been exposed to, which is an invisible toxin.
So that's Nikki Shepherd. Their website is, and they do all sorts of kind of consultations. They give loads of free advice, but they also do, if you really need someone to come and look in specifically into your whole situation, they can do that too. The website is emf-protection.co.uk. That's emf-protection.co.uk. www.theunionsaweek.co.uk, and that was Nikki Shepherd. A lot of this has kind of come out of the pandemic, Martin, that people are sort of getting together and at that conference and in other places to discuss how better to run. What's, in a nutshell, what do you think is the best way to run our national healthcare?
Well, we should stick to the basic principles of a nationalised industry. We need to bring that principle back in. And one of the things that Starmer has said, which I agree with, is that he's going to put doctors on the NHS payroll directly. Now, we'll have to see whether that comes to fruition, because they've always been subcontractors to the NHS as independent doctors. And of course, they've been encouraged by the Tories to set up all these.
Well, they've become managers, haven't they?
Managers,
yeah, of their own budgets.
That's
and this
right.
sort of thing.
And I think what they should be doing is what they should be doing is doing clinical analysis of what needs to be spent, and then we've got to go away and spend it. If that means money's got to be spent, health is the most important thing that people have. You spend the money. You need to, if you've got to raise the money, then you've got to think about where you're getting it from. But of course, in the 1950s, when the National Health Service was created, the top rate of tax was 95%. It was. Nobody made a fuss. The wealthy didn't like it, but it didn't really cramp their style that much. They just had to pay up.
Finally, before the break, before we go to Don DeBar after the break, we had a story this week, which is, I mean, beggars belief, really, which is about Bill Gates, Martin. Apparently, he's funding, and this is a tweet. I got this from Robert F. Kennedy's tweet, saying that Gates has got a mosquito farm, and there are all sorts of mosquitoes about to be released from Bill Gates' mosquito farm. Now, you know, I make the very basic sort of connection between Bill and his jabs and the fact that mosquitoes actually jab their little proboscis into your skin. This is the Bill Gates' mosquito factory in Colombia. Interesting place to run it. At least it's not in Ukraine, I suppose. It's the largest in the world. 30 million genetically modified mosquitoes are released every week in 11 countries. Bill knows better than nature. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, I understand the logic of this is that they will outcompete the malarial mosquitoes, and these are non-malarial mosquitoes. But it seems like Bill Gates is not the person to do anything about any of this. He's totally untrustworthy, and he's a for-profit person, whatever
it
else he says.
It seems to me we've got these kind of characters wandering around the world stage now that are just in charge. People like Elon Musk as well, just in charge, yeah, because they're rich.
Yeah, that's right. They're given all this credibility because they're supposedly brilliant minds, like Trump, of course, brilliant minds.
You've got little government departments and research centres and things like that that are publicly accountable, that are strapped for cash, and the roof is leaking.
That's right. And, of course, the other real solution for things like malaria in developing countries is to make sure everybody has got mosquito nets. Astonishingly, poor people can't afford them. They ought to be able to afford them. They ought to be provided for free to everybody. But they're not, because the money that's collected in taxes in developing countries goes straight off to the City of London as debt payment. If we wanted to do with lots of problems in the world, we should cancel third world debt. The lot of it. All of it. Eventually, it's not going to be paid anyway.
Gonna go to the place that's the best. lots of us just sell out right away.
So that's Biss from 1996 with Teensy Power. Is it a Vampire soundtrack EP? I seem to remember John Peel telling me at the time. And before that, 1970, Norman Greenbaum with The Spirit in the Sky. Boris Johnson cancelled. Donald Trump cancelled. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner on the talkradio.org.uk stream and live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, not necessarily Google. Joining me is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and I hope from the United States, Don DeBar, Tony Gosling here, of course. Don, are you there?
Yes, I
am. Don, just give us, for those that haven't heard you before, a brief resume of your activities. You're somebody who was working, I think, wasn't it, in property and then got into radio in the States.
Yes, my business career, whatever profession, was in the title insurance business in New York, which is, in essence, a conjunction of real estate law, finance, and you know, things that have to do with real property. I have been always interested in politics, and particularly in journalism and politics, and since I was 6 years old. And when I got into late 30s, early 40s, I started interacting with people who were doing journalism. I was interacting with them as an activist and sending press releases and all of this, and a lot of folks in independent media in the New York and U.S. areas were seeing my work, and a couple of them said, why don't you come work with us? And so I ended up at WBAI Radio, which is one of Pacifica Radio's stations, the one in New York. I was there for a while. And since then, I've been doing political commentary. I do a piece for the afternoon drive time news at KPFK in Los Angeles pretty much every day, Monday through Friday, and a bunch of other stuff. I'm going to be traveling through China beginning the end of this month to the middle of next month, and the Old Silk Road, looking at the situation of Muslims up close, aside from the propaganda that's being pushed out.
No, so is that paid for by the Chinese?
No, it's paid for by me.
Okay, well done.
I wish the hell somebody was paying for it.
Well, that's lovely, isn't it? But you see, the thing is, so many of these things, the reason I ask is because of what we quite often hear from is journalists who are paid by someone who's got an agenda on these things. So what's your agenda on this issue, or don't you have one?
My agenda is to observe and report. So, you know, one of the primary points of propaganda about China that's used by the United States, you know, forgetting whatever China really is, which is a whole other big question, there's supposedly an oppression of minorities in China, particularly the, depending on the pronunciation, the Uyghurs, the Igers, the Uyghurs, the folks in the up in the northwestern part, like what would be Seattle on a map of the United States. In general, an alleged intolerance and racist ideology towards the other among the Chinese elite and chosen. This is the subtext, not even subtext, but this is the propaganda position of the U.S. In other words, the white supremacist culture that conquered the world, including China, that devastated cultures from one side of the planet to the other, that extincted any number of people, they are pointing fingers at China. So I thought, gee, if we go there and bring a camera and talk to people, let's find out what's actually happening. And so that's what I'm going to do. That's what a journalist is supposed to do.
That's what they are supposed to do. But, you know, this is what amazes me, is quite often with these big, important stories that you're only getting one side. Anyway, so what do you make of, before we start talking about Donald Trump, what do you make of Joe Biden talking about building a railroad across the Indian Ocean this week?
What? I didn't even hear that one. Run that by me again.
Oh, well, actually, I can dig you out the audio of it if you want.
Let's listen to that together.
Yeah, we can do that. But can you, in the meantime, can you just tell us something about this guy? I mean, he's saying, oh, I'm probably going to get into trouble now. I'm going off script. That's what he said just afterwards. So he doesn't really seem to be, and I don't know if it's anyone in the world, apart from someone who's been paid to say it, that would say that he's all there.
Well, and even then you have to pay them handsomely because they have to live with that later. First of all, you know, he's one of a number of American politicians. You know, there's, for example, Hank Johnson, who's a representative, a Democratic representative from a district in Georgia, the state of Georgia, who at a hearing, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago now, 5 years ago or something. This is a guy that Nancy Pelosi picked to replace Cynthia McKinney in Congress because they didn't, the Pelosi and whoever the hell she actually works for, did not want to have Cynthia McKinney in Congress. So they did all these, you know, machinations.
Yeah, she was brilliant. Cynthia was fantastic. She was a 9/11 truth person, wasn't she?
Yeah, among other things, yeah. And so once they pushed her out, this is the guy who ended up in that seat. And he once at a hearing was making an inquiry. They were doing something to do with the Pentagon or military spending or whatever, and had to do with Guam, with the military base at Guam. Guam is like this island that is essentially it's American military bases, and then the people of Guam get to occupy like a corner over here, you know, or bob offshore. And they were discussing a construction project or funding some construction project or something, and he said, well, have any of the engineers looked to sea to make sure it's not going to sink into the ocean if we build this? So Joe Biden talking about building a railroad in the Indian Ocean is not unique among the geniuses in Washington, D.C. That's my point.
Yeah. Okay, so let's have a listen now to this is off-script Biden.
Well, we're going to win and we're going to help. We have plans to build a railroad from the Pacific all the way across the Indian Ocean. We have plans to build in Angola, one of the largest solar plants in the world. I can go on, but I'm not. I'm going off script. I'm going to get in trouble.
Yes, you certainly are. A railroad across the Indian Ocean. Apparently, he's just really reacting to, and he's trying to sort of put down the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative when he's saying, actually, the Americans are building this Indian Ocean Railroad. Give us your summary of Biden, because a lot of people have voted for him in the States because they really wanted to have a more inclusive nation that felt like it was much more welcoming to foreigners, for example, and they see the Republican Party as too jingoistic.
Well, okay, first of all, in terms of Biden's vote, a lot of the voters shared the surname Occupant, and he definitely won the cemetery vote. There were allegations that are very credible of ballot box stuffing that occurred in the swing states that swung in the middle of the night from Trump to Biden, that swung the election from Trump to Biden. So as far as all that goes, that question hangs anyway.
Wasn't there an inquiry into that found Biden innocent?
No. The fundamental legal issues involved as to whether or not there should have been this huge number of paper ballots was never touched by the courts. It rested upon the fact that the change in the law that enabled this in the swing states, particularly in Pennsylvania and Georgia, was not accomplished by the state legislature. And in fact, in Pennsylvania, it was rejected by the state legislature and instead was done by a governor's executive order or by the attorney general's interpretive ruling or by the commissioners of elections rules change. And if you look at the U.S. Constitution, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, the conduct of the presidential election shall be as established by the legislatures of the various states. It's not the exact language, but that's the exact intent and the exact verb, you know, the exact statement. And so there was this jockeying that was going on in 2019 before the COVID epidemic to accomplish this huge expansion in the use of paper ballots. Now, normally, paper ballots are for people that are going to be sick or on vacation. They call them absentee ballots. I'm going to be absent.
Well, we have postal ballots here.
Yeah, I think that's what you mean, isn't it? Postal.
Yes, exactly. It's remote balloting on paper. They send you the ballot. You fill out the ballot. Ostensibly, it's you. And then it gets submitted. The reason I made the comment about occupant, for example, is what happened in districts in Philadelphia, which swung Pennsylvania, was there was a massive distribution by mail of ballots to people that they weren't on the rolls anymore. Some of them were dead, and a lot of them voted. And this was never examined by the courts in Pennsylvania. It was dismissed. One court said, we are reluctant to step into this particular controversy because we don't think it's the role of the courts to upset the result of an election. That's what they said in the statement.
What we get week after week here is that this is all a farce and that Trump is ridiculous to question the result of that ballot. But anyway, I think, you know, you've certainly given us some of the other point of view. So what do you make of this week's prosecution of Trump? I mean, he takes a bit of a different attitude to Boris Johnson in that he will go pretty much straight out into the public and give his views about all this. We've had basically Boris's mates over here when he's been forced to resign as an MP talking about that, but in the US it's very different. Can you just give us a bit of background on this legal case against Trump, apparently having documents, I suppose we should say allegedly having documents that are a threat to national security in a box in his garage that shouldn't have been there?
Well, first of all, the term of art, I guess, for what's happening here is this is a phenomenon that we see not just with Trump and or with Boris Johnson. We saw it with Mel Zelaya in Honduras. We saw it with both Dilma Rousseff and also with Lula in Brazil. We saw it with Fernandez Kirchner in Argentina. In other words, what happens is where the machinery of power is not able to contain the dissatisfaction of the people at the ballot box, then by other means, other parts of the machinery of the state, they take out this particular threat to their position. Forgetting whether Trump really is or is not a threat to bourgeois control or even imperialism or whatever, there are things that he does and says that are not acceptable, obviously. I mean, it's this deduction on my part, but it is obvious that he does something that makes a broad part of the power structure unhappy enough to spend a whole lot of time talking about him and how he's the most evil and stupid and horrible person that ever lived, and so is anyone that would think of supporting him.
Well, I mean, maybe they've spent quite a lot of time accumulating lots of mass media chips, lots of judicial chips, and they're actually rather like using them from time to time and say, right, we're going to use them against this particular candidate.
Yeah, there's that. But he's kind of unique. I mean, I remember Howard Dean, for example. You know, he was running as a sort of an anti-war candidate against the Iraq War in 2004. And he had, just because of that, because he was perceived as that, okay, he wasn't Dennis Kucinich by any means or Cynthia McKinney by any means. But you know, he was perceived as that enough where it lifted him out of oblivion to being, it was a front runner for a minute. So he's at a rally and he's enthusiastic and he screams or whatever. They capture the scream and they play it across the media over and over, and they name it the scream heard around the world. And it's supposedly, it becomes, in the culture, evidence of him being unhinged. Do you want this screaming crazy guy to have his finger on the button? You know, those same media outlets haven't raised a question about the guy who takes instructions from the Easter Bunny, who's conducting a war against Russia, having his finger on the button. But they took Howard Dean out doing that. Donald Trump has been promoted by the media, you know, since, I don't know, I remember in the early 80s even. In the 80s, Michael J. Fox movie, Donald Trump does a walkthrough in the hotel that he's a concierge at. And this is like an illustration of, you know, the hoi polloi or the billionaire class or whatever. all kinds of media, anywhere he's there. He's got product placement like crazy. He's going to run for president. I'm being interviewed by Russian TV and Chinese TV and everybody else but American TV about the election in the middle of 2015. And Jeb Bush is running, you know, at the top on one side, and Hillary Clinton is leading on the other. This is 2015. And so they're talking about the stories are all positioned around the two dynasties and all this stuff. And then they ask me about Trump. And I'm in New York and I'm in real estate. OK, so I know exactly what he is. The main thing this guy, his main product is his name. He licenses his name to real estate projects so that they can call it a Trump property. And suddenly the value of it goes up 20%. And they pay like, you know, whatever, 5% or something. They make money on this. So I'm saying to them, look, he's running for president. He's enhancing the value of his product. That's what it is. And I had no idea he'd actually ever have a chance of getting elected or that he wanted to. He said, and they're promoting the hell out of him. Then he says, maybe NATO is obsolete. And all of a sudden, all those characters that did all the stuff to Howard Dean came out of from the four corners under the rocks, every damn place they were, and they came and they started trashing them. And then they did the same thing they did to Howard Dean. They turned off his mic. And then nobody heard from Trump for like a couple days. Every 4 years, the news channels make their bones, and the newspapers make their bones, that this their money, their ad revenue is during a presidential election year because people look at that media then. Well, when Trump was out, they stopped looking, and they noticed it within a week. And suddenly, they had to cover him, but they had this problem that he was speaking heresies. And once he saw that, he continued to do it. Iraq was a mistake. You people lied. You saw that in one of the debates. And, well, here we are. This is the only way they can take him out. He would be president. He's winning. He's leading everybody again in the polls. And he was already indicted before this indictment. People are sending him money like crazy because they understand there's a contradiction with the system, and they understand that their lot, their precarious situation, their discomfort is a consequence of the way the system treats them. And so they got a problem with the system, and they see him not even as like their hero or the guy in a white knight, just as an enemy of the system, and therefore I'm with you.
What about the rights and wrongs of the case, though?
Oh, in terms of the case itself, it's an absurd case. He was president of the United States. The right to classify and declassify documents rests entirely with the executive branch. The president is the penultimate officer of that. At will, he declassifies things. Congress has no right to infringe on that, and nor do the courts.
Well, he's not president anymore. I think what they're saying these documents, he can't just declassify them president.
No. When he took them, he declassified them.
Right.
There's no formal act required.
Oh, okay. Right.
The act of taking the documents and then walking out as a civilian is an act of declassification. They said it to Clinton. When the Clintons took the furniture when they left, aside from a boatload of documents. what's his name? Mamaroneck. I can't remember the name of this. There's a group, Judicial Watch, sued. They sued the National Archive, whatever the hell they call the group of knuckleheads that are in charge of the papers. And everybody else involved, and the court said, you know, you're right, this really is not a good thing, but sorry, he's the president. When he touches it and says it and declassifies it, he doesn't have to say it out loud. If he says it in his head, if it's intended to declassify, it's declassified. Period. That's a standing case, by the way.
Interesting, and especially if there's precedence for it too. And let's have a listen now to Donald Trump. He jetted off to Bedminster. I'm not quite sure where that is. That is actually a district of South Bristol here as well, which is not necessarily the place you'd expect to find Donald Trump. It's a kind of Bristolians, localers, rather poorer end of town. But anyway, this is what he had to say.
When murders are allowed to roam, murderers, these are horrible killers, murderers are allowed to roam the streets of our Democrat-run cities unchecked, but the incompetent district attorney in New York indicts Trump for a crime that everybody agrees, every pundit, everybody, There is no crime. But murderers go out and nobody ever even comes and knocks on their door, and they know they're there, and they know their rooms, and they know their locations, and they're roaming our cities all over, and some of them are coming in right now through our borders. But then you have a nation that, as we are, is in serious, serious decline. We have a nation in serious decline. If the communists get away with this, it won't stop with me. They will not hesitate to ramp up their persecution of Christians, pro-life activists, parents attending school board meetings, and even future Republican candidates, which they do. We must end it permanently, and we must end it immediately. Now that the seal, so important, is broken, the seal is broken by what they've done. They should never have done this. This was an unwritten rule. You just don't. Unless it's really bad. But you just don't. But the seal is now broken. In addition to closing the border and removing all of the criminal elements that have illegally invaded our country, making America energy independent and even dominant again, and immediately ending the war between Russia and Ukraine, I'll have it ended in 24 hours. I will appoint a real special prosecutor to go after the most corrupt president in the history of the United States of America, Joe Biden, and the entire Biden crime family. Name a special prosecutor. And all others involved with the destruction of our elections, our borders, and our country itself. They're destroying our country. And when I'm reelected, and we will get reelected, we have no choice. We're not going to have a country anymore. I will totally obliterate the deep state. We will obliterate the deep state. And we know who they are. I know exactly who they are. They want to take away my freedom because I will never let them take away your freedom. It's very simple. They want to silence me because I will never let them silence you. They want you silenced. And I am the only one that can save this nation because you know they're not coming after me, they're coming after you, and I just happen to be standing in their way, and I will never be moving. On November 5th, 2024, justice will be done. We will take back our country, and we will make America great again. Thank you. God bless you all. Thank you. Thank you very much. Great job. Thank you.
Okay, so that's Donald Trump speaking this week, Martin. We had to say goodbye to Don DeBar. If you want to catch up with him, he's now live on Press TV, although, of course, that's banned in Britain. You can find it online, and you can watch him live if you want to now, although I suppose I shouldn't be saying don't listen to this show. Don is over there now live on Press TV, the Iranian state broadcaster in English. He's pressing some buttons there. I'm going to get rid of the deep state. I'm going to stop the Ukraine-Russia war. And as Don mentioned, out of NATO.
He didn't mention NATO.
Not in that speech, but he said it, hasn't he?
He did say it in the past. He said NATO is obsolete, which is what he said in the past. And Macron actually said NATO is brain dead. And there you go. Tell Rishi Sunak.
So anyway, what do you make of that speech there? I think Trump certainly seems to me to be much more likely to be back into US politics than Boris is in British politics.
I think you're right on that front. It's very hard to predict what may happen in the US because it's a complex setup where
I know who they are, he says.
Yes, I know. That's the sort of thing he would say.
Yeah.
Does he know who they are?
I know who they
are. Maybe he does.
Maybe, I think he probably does. Yeah, he's probably been working with them. Well, he's probably had big shouting matches with them in the White House.
One of them whispered in his ear and said, why don't you assassinate General Soleimani in Iraq? And he did it.
Yes.
Which, of course, could have caused World War III just like that.
Well, possibly.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not trying to say that the guy's perfect.
No,
but he certainly, you know, there's a lot of criticism right across the press, constant criticism and hatred on Trump. And yet, you know, he's actually quite genuinely popular, and he's saying things that are unsayable, like, I'm going to put an end to the deep state.
Well, that's pretty much what Robert F. Kennedy's saying. And don't forget, his father was assassinated by the deep state, and he's always said, "I'm going to hold you to account."
I would like to have asked Don actually, but I should have done if I'd realised he was going to be off at 5:30. Robert Kennedy.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's happening is U.S. politics, because of the primary system, you've got a chance for more radical voices on the left or the right to win the nomination to be president, although the systems within the Democratic and Republican parties are stacked against that. Trump may come back. It's certainly feasible. I don't know if he will, because the deep state is not just going to roll over and go, yes, we're going to let Trump back in. And, you know, things can happen in a year. It seems to me that
Our politics is really sort of split into people that speak from the heart. And there are one or two left, even if they're crooks. And those that just, all they can do really, like Rishi Sunak, is just read a script. And they seem to come across as kind of wooden, as puppets, many of the modern politicians now. And there are very few people who can actually talk off the cuff without having to read a script. I mean, they use the auto cues, don't they? Like our very own mayor, Marvin Rees, he's got quite a clever auto cue that if you didn't know it was there, you wouldn't necessarily see it. It's an angled mirror, and there's several of them around the room. So he's moving his head around. You're thinking, oh, maybe he's thinking this in his own head, but actually he's not. He's just reading it. Someone else has written the speech for him.
Yeah, because that has been shown to be the way in the TV age, as it were, and the social media age, that you win elections.
Just look. It's the way you convince people that you're talking off the cuff.
That's right.
Because people actually want to see that this is someone that's actually like almost like a hustling, say in the city centre.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I don't know if you remember back to the 1980 election, where Michael Foot was the Labour leader, and he was a renowned orator from the 1930s. You know, all of that stuff that Trump was doing, all of the, you know, the building the tension and, you know, having a catchphrase and all the rest of it. And at one stage, he did an expansive gesture with his hand and knocked the microphone off the table so that nobody could hear what he was saying. And that was the Labour Party at that era. Because they then, what you've got now is it's all run by suits who have got, and PR women, you know, running around with clipboards to make sure that nobody says anything stupid. I mean, obviously, the problem with Biden, as we heard earlier, is he can't read the auto cue, so he just then starts extemporizing, and what he comes up with shows that he's not all there. Now, Trump is all there. But of course, what I found particularly sinister about what he was saying is the murderers that are coming into our country.
He wasn't just talking about them. He was saying the murderers are already there, some of them.
Yes,
so they're coming across our borders.
Yes, but
actually, this is worth pointing out. The Nottingham business this week, there seems to have been, I mean, just chatting amongst other journalists, there seems to have been possibly a news blackout on it because of the guy's ethnicity. Worried that there might be race riots they found out that
I understand one of the people killed was of an ethnic minority. So, you know, we don't know about this yet. So we do know.
I'm not jumping to conclusions. The guy as an asylum, if the guy is an asylum seeker, not actually a British citizen, and he was also mentally ill. I mean, God knows what was going on there. Maybe something to do with drugs, but the fact of the matter is that the guy who's accused of it, let's just make it clear, it is only accusations, that the police were holding back on releasing any information about him because they were worried about race riots.
Well, I think that's a matter for the police, and we could discuss that, or we could talk about Trump, Tony.
I'm saying it's linked, isn't it?
Well, I mean,
you cannot talk about people's ethnicity in relation to crime.
Yes, all right, but let's talk about...
I mean, the fact is, of course, that there is more crime in ethnic minorities, but that's not because they're ethnic minorities. It's generally because they're poverty-stricken.
That's right. That's why it's the prison population in the United States, the biggest prison population per head of any country in the world, is overwhelmingly black, because they were brought across as slaves. They still live at the bottom of the pile in the United States, and they're more likely to die in all kinds of criminal violence, gang fights and all the rest of it, because this is terrible. The murderers are running riot in Democrat-run cities. That's because the cities is where poor people live.
It's another
that's
related...
That's why they have the worst time in the society.
Related story, The Atlantic exposes CNN ban on reporting possible Wuhan lab accident because of racism. A leaked
leaked internal CNN survey finds that their own biased COVID coverage caused viewer distrust. Last week, The Atlantic dropped a bombshell story, news that confirms that the bigotries and tastes of the elite chattering classes, winding its way through 1,500 words, a length certain to exhaust all but reporters interested in industry gossip. The article's only point was to ding CNN's new CEO, Chris Licht, for directing the news outlet away from liberal programming and back to actual reporting that appeals to the majority of viewers. I'll put a link up to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Quite worrying to think that maybe that there was some pressure on reporters not to talk about this leak coming out of a Chinese lab, because people might then become racist against Chinese people, Martin.
Well, the whole thing has been manipulated from the beginning. I repeat this week after week, but the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States tipped off the Israeli Defence Forces that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China in November, before the Chinese knew about it. That is clear evidence that the Defence Intelligence Agency was involved. And if there were an independent police force, they'd already been caught. And so in actual fact, the whole thing is a deliberate creation of millions of deaths by the deep state. Now, is Donald Trump going to go there? I don't think he is. What he's doing there is he's whipping up his core audience, that they're Americans, they're special.
So
foreigners are the problem.
Biden is the one, is he?
They're all involved in it. Whoever's in charge is told what to do.
I don't think Robert Kennedy is.
No, that's why his father was killed. And of course, if he ever were to come close to winning, that's possibly what would happen to him. And that's the kind of state the United States is. It was quite clear that John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King were all murdered by the government. And then they turn around and point the finger at Putin and say, oh, he's a poisoner, he's this, he's that.
Yeah,
when
I say something about there being a Fourth Reich in the United States, then I get called a conspiracy theorist.
Well, that's right, because he is appealing to the narcissism of the United States. It's quite bad in this country, but it's even worse there. They really think that they are the supreme. You know, they're the ones to run the world, and everybody else is there.
Well, you're absolutely right.
It's just ridiculous.
Let's have the New York Times apparently has done a piece about the Ukraine's Nazi imagery. They say it's complicated. I say it's simple. It's Nazi imagery. Just running through some of the anti-war news on antiwar.com. Milley predicts a long, violent counter-offensive. I'm not sure if either of us do, Martin. The US is deploying F-22s to the Middle East aimed at Russia. F-22s in... What are they? They're not the F-23s, are they? What's an F-22, do you know?
I'm not offhand.
But anyway, the Americans putting planes into the Middle East aimed at Russia. What do you think's at the bottom of all this Russophobia? Because Russia is not actually a threat, as far as I can see, unless you're going to poke the bear.
Well, they thought they'd taken over Russia in the 1990s when Yeltsin was brought in.
And Berezovsky and the oligarchs.
Yes, that's
all
right. The oligarchy basically looted the country on behalf of the Western capital. And they, as far as they were concerned, that was the future of Russia. You are going to be a dependent colony of Western multinationals. You're going to be in the IMF and the World Bank, and we're going to tell you what your economic policy is going to be. And we're going to get that. What makes their mouth really water is all of the natural resources in Siberia, which could give capitalism a whole new lease of life, even though it's crashed. And, of course, they have to get that stuff in Siberia. It's not something that they are nice but not necessary. They have to get it if their system is going to survive. And, of course, it's not going to happen, and it isn't going to survive. Neither Trump nor his audience really understand that, I'm afraid.
Is Milley right predicting a long, violent counteroffensive?
There's going to be more. But they're already being mashed to bits. They've tried a few things on to try and break through the Russian lines, and it's just turned into a disaster for
them. We haven't had Scott Ritter on for a few weeks now, which I really should hang my head in shame. Fantastic analyst of all of this, and he spent a lot of time over the last couple of months over in Russia himself. So he was on Judge Napolitano's program this week talking about the counteroffensive, and particularly looking at how much manpower there is still left in the Ukrainian army, and apparently not much.
Here's General Milley earlier today. This is about boasting or stating, you can decide if it's a boast, about the Western, read NATO, and American training of Ukrainian troops.
More than 6,000 Ukrainians are being trained right now at 40 different locations in 65 courses in 33 nations on three continents. Since the beginning of the war, the United States has trained over 11,000 Ukrainians. We are currently training three battalions, a tank battalion and two territorial National Guard battalions. All in all, the international effort has trained almost 60,000 Ukrainian soldiers for this current operation.
Of what value is a statement like that, other than political?
It's purely political. General Miley knows. I'll give you, again, just falling back on Marine Corps. We can take a Marine who's been through his basic training, through his advanced individual training, an expert, not an expert, but competent in his weapons. We put them into a Marine unit, and they can spend a year incorporating. But before we deploy them, we take 6 months, train them up to the skill level necessary to be considered operational. 6 months, and this was a highly trained Marine. Now we're taking guys who are recruited, signing up, signing the dotted line in March of this year. We're sending them off for a couple of weeks training. Then we send them to Germany for 1 month of mind arms training. These guys don't know what they're doing. They are incompetent in the greatest degree, and it's being seen. They're brave. Let's never, ever pretend that the Ukrainian soldiers aren't brave or determined. They're trying to do something they simply can't do. Combined arms warfare is extraordinarily difficult. Even the Marines get it wrong when they're trained. The Army gets it wrong. Everybody gets it wrong because it's hard to do.
If I have you straight, what General Miley just said, he's the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for a few more weeks or months. He's a four-star. He's a Marine.
No, he's a soldier.
Would be irrelevant and impermissible for American troops.
Let me put it this way. If this was an American counteroffensive, and the Americans suffered these casualties, Congress would hold a hearing and General Miley would come through and talk about the training that has been prepared. And he would be court-martialed for being criminally negligent, because what he has done is taken people that we know are insufficiently trained for the task and we put them in combat anyways. General Miley is a liar. He is a criminal. He deserves to be prosecuted. And I would hope that the Ukrainians at some point in time, when this is all said and done, open up a case against him in the International Criminal Court, because to send these Ukrainian soldiers into those Russian defenses with equipment they don't know how to use, with tactics they don't know how to employ, with an operational doctrine that is broken, because at a minimum you require a modicum of air support. There is no air support. The Russians are slaughtering these people before they even get near the front line. And as they get near the front line, helicopters going up. You know how many helicopters the Ukrainians have shot down, Russian helicopters, in a very intensive combat zone? Zero. Zero, which means they don't have air defense because the Russians have taken it apart. This is murder. This is mass murder.
Here's General Miley a few minutes after the clip we just ran, ticking off a list of the military supplies that are on their way to Ukraine. He says it so fast you almost can't follow him. I'm sure you'll understand what this is. You can tell us what it means.
Last week, the United States released another Ukrainian Security Assistance Initiative package totaling several billion dollars, $2 billion. This package procures critical capabilities, including Patriot munitions, Hawk air defense systems, artillery rocket munitions, maintenance, sustainment support, and much more. Additionally, this week, we released our latest drawdown package of $325 million. From our current stocks, we are providing Ukraine air defense munitions, Gimlers, long-range artillery, artillery rounds, 155, Bradley Strikers, and many other capabilities.
Any of it going to help?
No. First of all, the drawdown that he's talking about is stuff they're going to draw down and send to the Ukrainians. The numbers he's putting out there is several battalions worth. It's just not enough. It's a joke, and he knows it's a joke. To give you an example, he talked about $300-some-odd million there. Right now, the Ukrainians are losing about $70 to $100 million worth of equipment a day. So, Miley, good job. You're going to give them 3 days' worth of equipment to go out there and get slaughtered, you idiot. The other stuff that he talked about, several billion, which became $2 billion, is not drawdown. It is because we have nothing left to draw down. So this is stuff that has to be built anew. So we're now procuring the money, sending the orders in, and this stuff isn't going to be finished coming out the pipeline for months, if not years. It is meaningless. Again, General Miley should be court-martialed. He's an incompetent fool. Unfortunately, he's obeying the orders that he's been given. So he's smart enough to know that every word he says is a joke. And why he's not crying, why he's not begging forgiveness for sending those Ukrainian soldiers off to die, because we knew they were going to die. No one believes this counteroffensive is going to succeed. We know it's going to fail. Those 60,000 troops, remember, that's the third army that NATO's built. People forget that. The first army, the Russians destroyed by June. The second army, the Russians destroyed by October of last year. The third army has been built. It's there now, and the Russians are destroying that. And there won't be a fourth army because there's no equipment left to give them.
No equipment left, Martin, apparently. It does seem like the propaganda around Ukraine is some of the most hateful, pernicious, destructive and murderous since the Ukrainians clearly cannot beat the Russians, especially, as Scott Ritter there pointed out, with no air support.
Yes, and of course our late, unlamented Prime Minister Boris Johnson went in April of last year to Kiev and told Zelensky not to negotiate a peace deal which was already on the table in Istanbul, brokered by the Turks and the Israelis. So none of this needs to have happened.
I wonder if Boris went and did that little job in order to try and ingratiate himself to the deep state, who then, of course, stabbed him in the back, so he didn't get anything out of that at all.
His problems in this country and Parliament are nothing to do with the deep state. He's going to go to America, and he will no doubt try and ride on Donald Trump's
coattails.
So
you don't think the deep state has anything to do with the Brexit or anything like that?
No.
That the deep state is quite happy for Britain to be completely independent of the EU and Brussels.
There was a struggle at the top in this country between people who didn't want Brexit and the people who did. That is an issue, but it's not the major issue that the deep state is concerned with. We need to get out of NATO, Tony. Now, Ireland is out of NATO because they went to war with us in the 1920s and earned independence from the United Kingdom.
They've never been in NATO.
They're not in NATO.
They've never been in NATO.
They've never been in NATO.
They've never got. They haven't got out of NATO.
Yes, because they were independent of the
French. Of were the French ever?
The French took. They've never left, have they? They're now out of the command structure and kicked out the US bases. Okay. Now, let's talk about the war in the Ukraine rather than the only reason.
The politics behind it, really, and what's going on with NATO. Because, you know, Stoltenberg, his term of office is up in September.
Yes, and it won't be Boris who will replace him. I'm pretty certain it's going to be somebody else.
Definitely not.
Because he's just too much. He just hasn't got the gravitas for it.
All you need to do if you want to find out who he's going to be is look at Bilderberg. Mm. The new NATO Secretary General, the front runners are Christia Freeland, she was at Bilderberg over in Lisbon, Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Finance in Canada. There's also someone called Mette Frederiksen, Prime Minister of Denmark. They quite like having ex-Prime Ministers. It's a bit like sort of having Tony Blair as Secretary-General of NATO, isn't it? Ben Wallace, UK Secretary of State for Defence. He's a Bilderberger too. And Ursula von der Leyen, the President of Europe. So those are the front runners. Those four names all died in the war Bilderbergers. So that's the sort of place where they're going to come from, I guess.
Well, of course it is. It's obvious. I mean, they're not going to go and pick somebody else.
Apparently, Stoltenberg has outstayed his term a couple of times anyway. So maybe just no one else really wants to take responsibility for starting World War III. And he's going to have to do it himself.
Well, I think
some of these people
The NATO Secretary General has generally been a European, because it gives the illusion that somehow the Europeans have some kind of say, whereas in actual fact they don't.
Or a Canadian. You know, one of the people. So that's why it could well be Christia Freeland, isn't it?
The problem for NATO is it's increasingly looking as if, all they've managed to do is start a war with the Russians, which they cannot finish. And, of course, you know, countries which are close, I mean, the Hungarians are basically saying, we've got to end this now. We've got to stop.
Before
it's pointless.
God slot, Martin, let's wind up on this, because you know a bit about Kosovo, having been over there when you were working for CAFOD. The Serbians, this is something which was on RT yesterday, Serbian authorities claim to have captured three armed Kosovo police officers in Serbian territory. A video showing the three masked men being arrested whilst carrying automatic weapons in full military gear has been shared by Serbian police, who claim the men were planning terrorist attacks. Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić, is it?
Vučić.
Yes, Vučić, said that the three men were arrested 1.8 kilometres inside Serbian territory and has laid the blame for the incident specifically on the Kosovo president, Albin Kurti, of inciting violence. We are at the crossroads, whether we will have peace or not, and there's one man in the Balkans who wants to incite conflicts at any cost. That's Albin Kurti, said Vučić in a live broadcast. So isn't it interesting how the Serbians have sided with Russia over the Ukraine war?
They haven't, actually.
Have they?
No, because well, they're under pressure from the West.
Yeah.
They've had to go a lot. They've not put sanctions on the Russians, but they've had to, you know, they're in a very weak position, the Serbs, because they're surrounded by hostile states and NATO. So there's a big tension between what the population are generally pro-Russian, but the government has to mind its P's and Q's, because they've got to keep the West happy, otherwise they're going to be punished, basically.
Serbia is shifting closer to Russia, apparently. But anyway, it looks like just for shifting close to Russia, even if they're not supporting them still, there's these terrorists being sent in from Kosovo.
Well, I think it's interesting, because I've just read an article about this last night.
This is NATO surely behind this.
Well, let me just pass this if you want to know.
Yeah, of course.
What's actually happened is after Serbian forces were driven out of Kosovo in 1999, there was a substantial Serb minority in the north of the country around Mitrovica. There were Serbs all over the country, but most of them fled because the Kosovo Liberation Army was essentially a sectarian force. You know, we don't like Serbs at all, a bit like Ukrainians' attitudes towards Russians. But in the north of Kosovo, which was traditionally the heartland of Serbia, but over the years gradually developed an Albanian Muslim majority, there's a substantial minority of Serbs, a bit like Northern Ireland in Ireland, yeah? So they're in that part of the country, they are a majority, and they just don't want to leave. And in actual fact, there's an ongoing tension between them and the central government in Pristina. Now, what's happened recently is that the negotiations are going on to try and solve this problem. But of course, it's fiendishly difficult because both sides are dug in a rut. Up to now, NATO has supported the Kosovo. Without, you know, they basically put them up to it. It wasn't them that decided to have an armed struggle against Serbia. It was the West that put them up to it. SAS trained them all and all the rest of it. Then what's happened now is that the Serbs boycotted the local elections in Kosovo. But the Kosovan government allowed Albanians to stand in those constituencies, and they won because the Serbs boycotted the election. And then they tried to enforce these people as mayors of the various parts of the Mitrovica pocket. And that's when the Serbs rebelled, yeah? They refused to accept these guys coming in. They stood up to them. They fought with the police. And then KFOR came, which is NATO, and they opened fire on the Serbian demonstrators. But interestingly, the EU and NATO have firmly slapped Kosovo down for all of this, because as far as they're concerned...
Yeah, but it's easy for them to do that. I mean, surely this cap of money you had for the Kosovans,
no.
That was them in the first place. The EU are coming along as a sort of good cop to NATO's bad cop.
Well, both the EU and NATO, if you let me finish, are not very happy about the Kosovans stirring things up at this stage, because they're putting pressure on Vučić to break with Russia. Mm. Are you following me?
Of course.
That's more important to them than Kosovo.
Yeah. I think it's obvious that there's political pressure and military. I mean, they're basically like gangsters. They're saying, look, unless you side with us over Ukraine, you're going to get loads of terrorist attacks.
Well, yes,
so
they may
country.
Be behind the terrorist attacks as well, but Hassan Fatchi, who is the head of the Kosovo Liberation Army, is currently in The Hague being put on trial for organ trafficking and various other evil acts. And even the Kosovo Liberation Army, which eventually came to power in Kosovo, was definitely regarded as a terrorist organisation at one stage, even though eventually the SAS trained them. And they brought in lots of jihadis from the Middle East.
I mean, when you were over there, did you ever feel used by, you know, CAFOD?
It was dangerous, Tony, and I don't think they understood quite how dangerous it was. I mean, not just because it was dangerous.
Giving money to the KLA.
I didn't give money to the KLA. That's
who,
not right.
Who was it? Who was it?
It was... Adam Demachi was a non-violent leader in Kosovo. He always condemned violence.
Yeah.
Right, that's the people we supported.
But didn't the money eventually go to buy weapons? No.
No, it didn't, Tony.
No, okay.
No, it didn't.
Well, that's good. That's lucky, because it's the sort of thing that might well happen.
Yes, it can happen. We gave lots of money to the Croatians, because they're Catholics.
Yeah.
A lot of that money did end up being spent on weapons. It was supposedly on food aid, but it got spent. That's what happened.
It's a dangerous game as an aid worker, isn't it?
Well, dangerous game, because it's a war, and people are killing each other.
Not just for you, but as to where the money's going to end up. Exactly. It's the same thing exactly in Ukraine,
One of the things I used to argue with my bosses back in London was we shouldn't just be handing out money like Smarties. We've got a budget here. Let's spend it wisely and spend it on things that we can be sure what we're doing. But there was always a pressure to just get the money out of the door so that they can turn around to the people in the Catholic faithful who've given the money and said, yes, we've spent £3 million in Kosovo. I resisted spending the money fast.
Not so much accountability as
well. I was also
be.
Asked to write a letter to the International Development Department saying we've already spent £3 million in former Yugoslavia, and we think we've done a good job. Will you give us £3 million more? And I had to write this letter because I was instructed to write it. But what I was arguing with my bosses was we can't spend the money we've got and be sure that it's being properly spent. Why are we asking the government for more money?
It amazes.
And the reason is because it's empire building by the organisation.
Well, it amazes me.
Everybody puts in these speculative...
It amazes me, Martin, that anybody can stay in a job like that long, because either you're going to get killed in a conflict zone or else you're just going to get totally fed up and think that, you know, well, my bosses are totally incompetent and I don't want to carry on doing this sort of thing
anymore.
They
were probably the best bosses I ever had.
Really?
Yeah, we didn't see eye to eye on everything, but I was given a lot of credit. You know, I ran my own show and I had to justify what I was doing. People shouldn't think that all charities are corrupt or the money always gets wasted.
There's a lot of criticism at the moment about Oxfam, and that's largely because Oxfam are actually doing a decent job.
Well, indeed, that's right. I mean, and the fact is there's going to be a problem in war zones in particular of money going around all over the place. You know, it's difficult.
Okay, Martin, well, we're going to finish up with, actually, it's Masonic politics this week on our God slot, and that's Malcolm Gree. But before that, we're going to have a poem from Patrizia Opulenza. Thanks very much, Patrizia, for sending another one in. I got slightly back on top of my emails again now. She sent a couple of poems in which I didn't read out. But anyway, this is a one. It's called An Ode to the Living Dead. And it's all about I don't know if you've seen this story, Martin, where there's a AI bot has actually been writing sermons in Germany. And the idea is that it's all you have is a computer at the front of the pew and AI bots read out the sermon. So I'll put a link to the story on our show page too, but far better, let's have a listen to Patrizia. Are they dead and buried, or just walking in our midst, abiding by the rules they're taught? Or do they get the gist? Some never know the thrill of thought, or to think outside the pen, just go along with all the rules and never asking when. Will the truth be taught in schools or shown on their TVs? Governments be truthful instead of doing as they please? Perhaps the answer, never know. But once you see the light, be born again at any age, where wings and life take flight. No more be shackled to the mist or to words without much thought. Air be breath of wonder, where the souls cannot be bought. Tread carefully around each soul, be it dead or perhaps alive. With hope in heart and kindly deeds, the dead may still survive. So that's Patrizia's poem, An Ode to the Living Dead. And we'll finish this week with a look at Freemasonry going on in the House of Commons.
Secrets and Lies. The Last Few Drops Squeezed from David Southwell. In his 1995 autobiography, Who Goes Home?, former Member of Parliament and Deputy Leader of the Labour Party, Roy Hattersley, unwittingly gave confirmation of one of the oldest and strongest rumours that does the rounds in the Houses of Parliament, that there is a hidden Masonic temple in the Palace of Westminster. The now Baron Hattersley recalled being mistaken for a Freemason by fellow Labour MP George Brown. Thinking Hattersley was about to leave the Houses of Parliament to attend a lodge meeting, George Brown told him, "You don't have to go outside. There is a special parliamentary lodge. Shall I get you transferred?" With two lodges of MPs and peers, and the gallery lodge, the Masonic lodge made up of journalists working in the Houses of Parliament, it is not surprising there is a temple for their use within the building. The fact that it is real has been confirmed to me both by non-MP Masons who have been shown it whilst visiting the Palace of Westminster, and by current MPs who have testified to its existence. The use of Masonic symbolism in the Palace of Westminster has long been established, from the chessboard floor of the debating chamber of the House of Commons, which has given us the famous phrase, "the floor of the House," to the precise symbolic measurements and Gothic design elements incorporated into the building when it was rebuilt by Charles Barry and Augustus Pugin, both noted Freemasons, after a fire in 1870. It now appears they also built a Masonic temple into the palace as well. The exact location of the temple within the Palace of Westminster is difficult to determine. There is a security presence, which makes exploring difficult. However, with almost 1,000 rooms, 100 staircases and more than 2 miles of passageways, there is more than enough space to accommodate it. As recently as the 1990s, several rooms which had been lost and unused for more than 70 years were rediscovered. It seems, however, that the temple continues to stay purposefully lost.
So that's Malcolm Grieve on, and the clip is from Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also, of course, to singer-songwriter Rita Lynch and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Not so easy to do that on the BBC website. They just like you to sort of hang on their website and listen to it directly from them. We just give you an MP3, do what you want with it, stick it in a box, stick it in your on a CD, stick it on a memory stick, but it's yours. It's not the BBC. They like to keep all their stuff to themselves, as do most broadcasters. Do send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page and my Telegram channel, I think they call it, don't they? You'll find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links and comment page, and our email addresses at thisweekoneword.org.uk. We've been streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, where you can hear this show repeated on Sunday early, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast the show, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.